Good Thursday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad that you've joined us today. We have a fantastic program for you up here at the Mothership. Mr. Jim Garrity of National Review is with us in studio all hour long. Get yourself situated. Strap on in there, Jim. How you doing?
There are no seatbelts, Cam.
That's true. I guess we don't have any.
I feel like I'm on
here.
A school bus, you know. Giant yellow machines of death. So, yeah. So. OSHA did not approve of this, but go ahead.
It's good to have you here.
It's good to be here, Cam. It's good to see you.
Yeah, absolutely. David Arsani of The Federalist is going to join us next hour. Says the Obama administration is now apologizing for winning World War II. It's a bit of a provocative headline. It's not like we've actually seen a formal apology of, you know, we're really sorry in the interest of fairness.
Hitler.
We should have led the right. It's wrong that America was so great back then.
Oopsie, Hirohito. Didn't mean to do that, Mussolini.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, if you think about it, Jim, you know, the Japanese at the time were told that they had to worship the emperor as a god. We destroyed their religion.
There you go. Yes, sir.
How awful of us.
There are certain times you shouldn't even bother to follow the sensitive social justice warrior political correct thinking down that line. At some point, you should say no.
As the son of a Navy veteran who was in a destroyer off the coast of Japan, I'm glad we won. And I'm glad my dad made it back safe and sound, because you know what? A lot of his friends didn't, unfortunately. Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart is going to join us next hour as well, talking about the four most infamous gun grabbers. Richard Grenell with the Coalition for More Civil Liberties yesterday saw Richard's tweet about Twitter yanking an ad campaign trying to gather signatures opposed to this anti-gun referendum, which is likely headed towards the ballot in California. After a very brief period of time, the campaign apparently was restored after, I'm guessing, some public pressure. We'll talk with Richard about it again in hour three. But, you know, it's interesting. We have all of these debates and discussions about the freedom of speech. Look, Twitter is a private company. Actually, it's a publicly held company, but it's a corporation. It can have whatever policies it wants. If it wanted to come out with a policy tomorrow saying, listen, we don't like conservatives, and our algorithm is going to make sure that, you know, conservatives don't really show up in people's Twitter feeds. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't like it, but at least they'd be honest and upfront about it. This is what I don't like. This is the concern, and this is where we as consumers, we have a job to do if we care about stuff like this. You have to read the fine print. You have to look at the terms of agreement on, you know, Facebook and
everything
other social
media. Everything you automatically click okay to without reading. Call your lawyer.
You know, bring him over. Pop some popcorn and, you know, some coffee, because you're going to be there a while, because it's like 47 pages now to scroll through. But yeah. I don't like the lack of transparency.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that, you know, Silicon Valley says that it does better is that it is, you know, it is market-based. It's very altruistic in that sense. We're just trying to build a better world, Jim. And we're trying to, you know, without the bureaucratic clutter, because we've just got good hearts and kind souls and a ton of money.
Yeah.
Almost said something else. and you know, so we will build that better world. And, you know, sometimes that world that they're building looks a little creepy to me.
It's funny that this comes up in the context of certainly myself, a whole bunch of folks that I know. In fact, I noticed, Cam, is it just me, or are you not on Twitter as often and frequently as you used to be?
I am not on Twitter as often and as frequently as I used to be.
Okay. Now, at the risk of being too personal, is it the hogs and the chickens are requiring more time, or is it you actually you don't enjoy it as much as you used to?
I do not enjoy it as much as I used to.
Am I crazy for thinking it's, you know, Cosmo told me you're the devil, Cam Edwards? You know, that it's
Here's the thing. You're not crazy in thinking that.
Okay.
I actually don't get a lot of that.
Really? Okay.
To be really honest with you, I don't. In fact, I'm kind of shocked that I don't get more of it.
Okay.
When Cosmo and Everytown decided that I was going to be the gun splainer of the day, I fully thought that I would be responding to people, you know, who are. I didn't get one single, not one, Jim.
Wow.
Not one. All right. So I don't know. Maybe I don't know. Maybe I'm being shadow banned already, or maybe because I don't put a lot of that out there, I don't get a lot of that back. But what I do see is like 70% or more of my Twitter feed. You suck. No, you suck. You suck. And it's this spiral. And I can be on for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then I just think, and I have to get off.
Thanks to the miracles of modern technology, whether it's on your laptop, on your iPad or other, you know, tablet device or on your phone.
You can be yelled at.
Thanks to Twitter. First of all, you instantly get told of every terrible thing that happens anywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, like ordinarily you'd have to wait until the next morning to hear about a landslide in India that killed a whole bunch of kids or something. Like something, oh my God, that's terrible, but something you can do really nothing about. Now you can know about it instantly. Or even worse, what if someone said something controversial who you've never heard of, right? You know, but all of a sudden that becomes the next big huge thing. It's no one's surprise that this has been a particularly impassioned and divided and controversial Republican primary. I and my employer, National Review, have been very clear about where we stand on evaluating certain candidates. And people hate us for it. You know what? It's free country. You're free to think of us, whatever you want. I'm free to think whatever I want. But on Twitter, everybody just, they'll put it out there. And often from egg accounts with no pictures themselves. Often with people are always, as we feel have seen since the dawn of social media and the internet. Is it somebody who said everybody on the internet is 6'2" and 250 pounds and ripped and all, you know?
Right.
You know,
I remember the saying on the internet, no one knows you're a dog.
Yes. You know, and similarly, everyone can claim
but
to
everybody
be
knows you're a butthole. That's the problem because everybody, you know, the jerks put it out there. And I apologize if that has to be bleeped, but, you know, that's the problem right now is that, you know what? You can tweet anonymously. Look, I am not a believer in the idea that we should not have anonymous speech. You go back to the founding of this country, that was what the Federalist Papers were.
Silas Duguid would agree with you, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, but, you know, Silas Duguid wasn't writing to say John Dickinson sniffs goat farts. You know, like, that's not what he was writing. Silas Duguid was, you know, I'm going to write the things that would get me thrown in prison.
Yeah.
If you know my name were known, or I want to present an argument without the baggage that comes with being Ben Franklin or John Adams or Alexander Hamilton. Mm-hmm. I want my argument to matter, not who I am.
You remember the Norman Rockwell's paintings of the Four Freedoms, and one of them was the freedom of speech. And there's this guy standing up at his, I don't know if it's a town hall meeting. He's standing up. You can kind of see in his eyes a little bit of nervousness, but mm-hmm. he's speaking his mind, and people around him are looking at him. And you can tell some people agree with him, some people don't agree with him. And it's kind of this maybe even slightly idealized vision of what American democracy and free speech and the exchange of ideas is supposed to be like. And, yes, it's not always going to be that quite so polite. Cam, did you happen to catch the YouTube video of the crazy woman yelling at Rick Scott in the Starbucks about a week or two ago?
We've talked about it. I didn't watch it.
Now, Rick Scott, you know, I'm sure he thinks he's been a great governor. They got about a million jobs. But maybe there are people who think, Rick Scott, you're not doing a good job. He goes into Starbucks for what apparently seems to be the longest latte creation process ever. I'm sure at that point he's like, I should have just taken a grande to go. I should have just taken the basic. I didn't need it half calf with whip and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I don't know what he ordered, but whatever it was, it was taking a really long. And this woman just starts shrieking at him, you know, you should be ashamed of yourself. And it's this straight, like, you know, on the one hand, we all believe in freedom of speech, but it's probably not the right time and place, and he's got a right to get a coffee as much as anybody else. And
sure, but here, look, yeah.
But so this broad, you know, if decorum in face to face is breaking down, mm-hmm. if our expectations of how we treat each other in a public place has broken down, then clearly it's unthinkable to expect there's going to be anything in it with everyone's protected through anonymity, as on social media, and in comes Twitter, say, oh no, don't worry, everyone. We have it's not the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Trust and Safety Council.
Trust and Safety Council. Yeah.
Right.
You know, and I don't know about you. I always picture the Apple 1984 commercial. You know, welcome to the Trust and Safety Council. You know, we will ensure everyone on Twitter is full of trust and safety. No controversial thoughts will be. You know.
Or there was also the BBC did a the British government did a campaign probably 10 years ago. To promote the use of CCTV cameras everywhere, and it was secure beneath the watchful eyes. And there were these eyes in the sky watching everything.
Yes, the giant
everything.
Floating eyeballs that are not creepy in any way, shape, or form, you know. it's a beholder from Dungeons & Dragons, but a really obscure, both listeners got that joke and enjoyed it. the idea that Twitter was going to step in. And here's so they announced this, and it's like, you know, by and large, like 90% lefty groups, fine. So the first two couple of things they've done is we go after Robert Stacey McCain, mm-hmm. conservative blogger, who, let's face it, no stranger to controversial remarks. And I guess part of the thing is that they haven't really specified, well, at least Robert Stacey McCain says he's not been told what he did that caused his account to be shut down.
Right.
Now, if you told me Robert Stacey McCain wrote something really, really controversial, offensive that, you know, just warranted this, I'm not immediately saying, oh, there's no way he'd ever do that. He's a very outspoken guy, very, you know, not like he's never shocked someone before. But it'd be nice to see, oh, he wrote X. We've decided that X is against our standards and not permissible on Twitter. Thus, you know, but they won't say what X is. And that mm-hmm. feels a little bit like, well, you've been charged with a crime and punished, but we're not going to tell you what the crime was. And, you know, punishment before, there's no sense of appeal. There's no way to work around it, things
right.
like that. And so for whatever he did that offended someone, that caused, you know, the equivalent of the Twitter death penalty to come down upon him, you know, everybody you know who's on Twitter has been called all kinds of horrible names 10 times a day. And if you block someone, and, you know, I have found myself using the block button more than I ever expected I would over these last, you know, 2-3 months, you end up, the next person, you know, someone can set up a new account,
mm-hmm.
new name, slightly changed, and start sending the exact same stuff to you. Like the traditional ways of, I don't want to deal with this person. This person is abusive. This person is profane. This person is obnoxious. They're not interested in exchanging ideas. They don't have an argument. They're not telling me. They just want to, you know, scream profanities at me. I would not interact with this person any more than I would interact with a person screaming at me on the street.
Or in a Starbucks.
Yeah, you know. So Twitter hasn't figured out how to deal with that. But you know, Robert Stacey McCain would come down on like a ton of bricks.
Yes. And again, there's a lack of transparency.
Making us think that it's not really about, you know, safety and building a more comfortable conversation environment or anything like that. That it's not really about making, you know, eliminating hostility and profanity and things that, you know, make people turn away from Twitter. So the irony is they get rid of Robert Stacey McCain and everybody who follows him. But then if you find, or if anybody else finds this, you know, constant vomiting forth of all the obnoxious names that, you know, Trump fans call me, and apparently the Never Trump crowd has called Trump fans me, you know, like it's a really nasty, toxic place of that stuff, you know, and racist speech and all kinds of stuff like that. To use a perfect example of this, Guy Benson was talking about this a little while back. So Mary Catherine Hamm writes her column about Donald Trump and Ivanka Trump, and many people start saying, I'm glad your husband's dead. Screw these people. Right? Like at that, like, you know, this is the sort of thing that will make me fly off the handle. You know, that's not worth banning an account, right? That's not something that we're going to do, it just seems so arbitrary and so designed to get rid of whoever offends the people on this health and safety commission or whatever the heck it's called,
mm-hmm.
and not about actually enforcing any type of uniform, understandable, open standard of what Twitter considers to be acceptable discourse.
Well, and again, I don't know that, not being privy to the inner machinations of Twitter, I don't know that sort of libertarian ideal towards the freedom of speech and let's let this be a platform. It sure seemed like that was a big selling point for Twitter in the early days.
There was never any, you know, Twitter board that had to approve your tweets, you know?
No, yeah. But it also seems to be like, I remember Twitter kind of talking up the fact that people in places, you know, where there were repressive regimes, they could, you know, there was the possibility that they could speak up and speak out.
We have the social media platform that North Korea is going to love.
You know? But, you know, but now, again, it's about fairness and not justice. It's about, you know, again, these, you don't know what the rules are. They're probably ever changing. But here's the other thing. So you could say, you know, well, look, in this case, you know, private enterprise, meh. It could be done better. And maybe there will be a real free speech a platform or a platform that is, you know, dedicated to openness and transparency in terms of its policies that will develop. Maybe Twitter will change its own policies. But you wouldn't get anything better from a government-run, you know, the GovTweet,
yeah.
Right? I mean, like, there would be policies, I would think, at this point that would be even more restrictive. You would likely see even more political gamesmanship being played. And I don't think that Robert Stacey McCain would be welcome on GovTweet either.
GovTweet would probably be about roughly as effective as Government Motors, the old GM, which we spent a lot of money to save a company that ended
now known as Fiat. Is that right?
Well, no, I'm thinking specifically about GM, where they, we spent
Chrysler,
a lot of money
okay.
to save the company yeah. that ended up making cars that if you had, your keychain was too heavy, your car would kill you. Well done, America.
The original.
Yes, exactly.
Back in the old days. Yeah. Okay.
Well, the old days of like Obama's first term. Yes.
Oh, the first, okay.
Yeah, you know, the ignition, you put it in there, and at some point, if your keychain is too heavy or if you bump it with your knee, the car will turn off and you'll die.
You know, honestly, Jim, like this should tell you how busy the last 7 years have been. Yep. That one completely, like,
there you
didn't
go.
Even
yeah.
register with me.
Yeah, so hope you're not driving GM. and if so, take the heavy stuff off your keychain.
We are talking with Jim Garrity from National Review. I do want to take a time out. When we come back, I want to talk about Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, the New York primary. Hillary Clinton has been saying just the stuff that is coming out of her mouth. And you know, coming out on print when it comes to the gun issue, Jim, it's like Hillary's here, and then reality's like a few subway stops down the line, and her car just isn't working.
She just can't get into the subway system to get to reality.
She can't get there.
Yeah.
So we're gonna maybe give her a lift after a quick timeout. Stick around. There's much more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up next.
Speaking with Dennis Willing with the NRA Competitive Shooting Division. Dennis, welcome back to NRA News, and we are talking Bianchi Cup. It's that time of year again. What is the NRA Bianchi Cup?
Bianchi Cup is NRA action shooting. It is not a run-and-gun type sport like you see in some places, perhaps like three-gun. But it is a stationary sport where you compete against the clock. It's a combination of speed and accuracy, not of one's agility.
All right, and it's out in Columbia, Missouri, and it's in May 24th to 28th, correct?
Correct.
All right, and Dennis, we see some of the best shooters from around the country and quite frankly from around the world come out to Bianchi. Why is that?
It is just a very exciting sport that people enjoy very much because of it combines the speed and accuracy elements. We have a tremendous number of international shooters come over from Australia, New Zealand, and Germany, and who knows where, Canada. And we have recently generated interest, believe it or not, down in Chile. They're now running Bianchi Cup matches in Chile.
It's amazing to see this all coalesce at a shooting club in Columbia, Missouri every year. It's an amazing thing to see. And this year, brand new, a feature, a new championship round presented by Colt. That sounds like fun.
It is. It's going to make for an exciting finish. We're going to take the top divisions and divide them out and put them on the line. They're going to shoot head-to-head. They're going to shoot their first round, and then they're going to shoot a second round for the top competitors, and they're going to shoot for the cups, the women's cup, the men's cup, the production. It's going to be an exciting finish.
All right, Dennis Willing, thanks for what you do at NRA, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
The only truly free people who have ever walked this earth have been armed people, capable of defending themselves and their families. Americans look in horror at supposedly free countries all over the world where innocent people live or die at the mercy of their government. We see what it's like to be French, German, or Belgian, where innocent people cower in fear as evil closes in, utterly aware of their own vulnerability, doomed to defend their families with rolling pins and broom handles. Let the rest of the world choose to live in fear. That false brand of freedom will never be ours. We are free to be as armed, trained, and prepared as we see fit. And we will never surrender that freedom to the global gun ban order. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I grew up on the south side of Chicago. You know it as one of the most dangerous cities in America. I know it as something less than America, a place where the law doesn't matter. It's illegal for criminal gang members, drug dealers, and felons to even touch a gun. Chicago's politicians could clean the streets tomorrow just by enforcing that federal law. But they would rather attack the gun rights of good people, then crack down on the violent criminals who terrorize them. So law-abiding Southsiders put their kids to bed to the sound of gunfire, with no hope but to pray it doesn't come closer. Chicago's injustice is America's problem. Either we fight this cancer of corruption, or we pray it doesn't come closer. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, David Ersanya, the Federalist, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart. On the program next hour, right now, I want to welcome from National Review once again our friend Jim Garrity is with us. So tonight in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you your opportunity to do your fantastic. If there is a Bernie Sanders presidency, you know that you will be the, what was his name, Vaughn Mead, was that his name? The guy who imitated Jack Kennedy in the early 60s.
For listeners of a slightly younger vintage,
I wasn't
camp.
Even alive then. Let's just state for the record here.
Or the Dana Carvey to George W. H.
Yeah,
W.
Whatever.
Bush,
all
or
right.
or you know.
I'm always thinking old school.
There you go. Yeah, old school.
So, or Rich Little, but chance to just use your spot on.
Sure.
I realize Rich Little's still not particularly, you know. Crap.
Hang on, let me just dust off these references here, Cam.
Did you catch the new Stanford and Son last night? It was amazing.
Oh, Stanford or Sanford?
Stanford.
Okay, there you go.
I at least know that.
Stanford is the like very elite school one. So Bernie Sanders really set off Hillary Clinton supporters when he said she had said something indicating that she never said it directly, but implied he was not qualified to be president because he didn't know enough about how things work.
Right.
I don't think that you're qualified if you get $15 million from Wall Street through your super PAC. I don't think you are qualified if you have voted for the disastrous war in Iraq. I don't think you are qualified if you have supported virtually every disastrous trade agreement. Cam, is there a microphone in front of me? I just shout at people. I just shout and yell at people. And my voice cracks with that. So the problem with doing Bernie Sanders is it's very hard to stop. You know, yeah.
I heard him yelling on my way in this morning, and he seems to be losing his voice. He seems to be doing a lot of yelling these days. Of course, Hillary seemed to be losing her voice as well. They both seem to be yelling, very angry, and so in New York particularly, we saw this actually going back to Wisconsin and really even back to New Hampshire. Hillary Clinton has decided that she wants to be the anti-gun candidate, and this is one of the areas where she thinks she can carve out a little bit of daylight between her and Bernie Sanders, run to the left of Bernie Sanders, and differentiate herself, because not like she wants to talk about, you know, Wall Street and things like that, the great relationship there. So this is a way to differentiate herself. Sanders has been awful on guns too, so which makes the whole argument kind of laughable because, you know, the difference between the two candidates is maybe like a page thick. But they've been, Hillary's been focused on, Bernie Sanders' vote in favor of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, and also apparently blaming Bernie Sanders for Vermont's gun laws, saying that Vermont's guns are flooding into New York State, causing violent crimes there, and it's because of these states like Vermont, and this is why we have to have national gun laws. Now, 2008, Hillary Clinton said that Barack Obama was mm-hmm. out there trying to pass these federal gun laws, and she said what works in Montana might not work in Manhattan, so we don't need these federal gun laws. She would be so mad at Hillary Clinton in 2008 if she were willing to acknowledge Hillary Clinton in 2008.
What's more, Cam, I understand that the Hillary Clinton of 2016 campaign is actually now running attack ads against the Hillary Clinton of 2008, and they could do some real damage to her back then. So as you're describing this to me, Cam, I'm thinking back to
it would be fantastic, by the way, if we could have hologram 2008 Hillary debate 2016 Hillary.
I had wanted to have Charlie Crist in the process of switching from the Republican Party to the Independent to running as a Democrat. That when he ran for governor last 2014, he was the exact opposite of everything he was running for in 2006. So I really was hoping for like a time traveling Rick Scott from 2006 had traveled forward in time to debate his future self, to explain why his decisions were so right. And then I believe I've written this sort of like as a quasi-fictional story. The National Review let me write it because it was all about all the positions that he had in 2006. And now he was literally campaigning explicitly against all the decisions he had made, you know, like about a decade earlier. I had the Charlie Crist of 2018. Travel backward in time as the socialist candidate for governor, denouncing both past versions of himself.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Hillary 2008 was actually denouncing Hillary 1996, right?
Yes,
so, and now it's weird because Hillary Clinton is running. She likes the gun control part of the Clinton crime bill. Wants to talk that up. Doesn't want to talk about the actual crime bill.
The putting criminals in jail part is where she had a problem.
Right.
Yeah.
And so this has led to, at one point this week, Jim, this was the weirdest tweet I've ever seen. Hillary Clinton says, and we were just talking about how weird some of these tweets can be, Hillary Clinton talks about guns from Vermont committing crimes in New York. Guns committing crimes there. Because she cannot talk about criminals. Because someone might bring up the super predator comment, right? So I think she is so terrified. She'll talk about gun manufacturers. She'll talk about the gun lobby, gun owners, guns. Everybody's committing crimes except for the people who are actually committing the violent crimes.
Cam, these inanimate objects are floating up through telekinesis from some unexplainable force and committing crimes on their – we don't even know why they're robbing the banks because
they're
guns.
Spend
money. And they can't spend money. Invisible people. Yeah. But as you're describing this attempt, you know, one, it's a good indicator of how much the center of gravity has shifted within the Democratic Party on the issue of guns. And it's strange because, I've been doing the show since 2004, and you and I have been friends since then. I remember one of the first conversations with George W. Bush's reelection. There was concern that amongst the Second Amendment activists and the gun rights community, that there might be a little bit of complacency, a sense of, you know what, we've had the argument, we've won the argument, Bush has been reelected, there's a Republican Congress, we're going to be fine. Well, one, the Republican Congress didn't last very long. But two, that even as the Democrats had learned from Al Gore losing Tennessee in 2000, losing Arkansas, Democrats were going to give up on the gun control issue. It was really going to not be the core of their issue.
Well, and think about how they took back the House.
Mm-hmm.
This was the rise of the Blue Dogs.
Yep.
This was Rahm Emanuel.
The Jim Webbs of the world, yeah.
And Rahm Emanuel very specifically is head of the Democratic House Campaign Committee recruiting Blue Dog
the
Democrats.
The Heath Shulers of the world, yeah.
Right. But then, unfortunately, for those candidates – many of them got elected, and when they went to Washington, D.C., they were told that they had to vote like Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah. And, that created internal tensions there. Some did, some chose not to. A lot of them got wiped out in the two midterm elections of 2010, 2014. But the bottom line is that as much, even if the gun control issue hasn't been this great success, and you and I have had many a fun time making fun of Mike Bloomberg and all, how he spends a bazillion dollars and he keeps losing on referendums, losing on these state legislative races and things like that. Even though it's not a winning issue for them, even though they keep getting their tushes handed to them, they still want it, and they're still going to push for it. And if you are a Democratic presidential candidate, you have to act like gun control is the obvious, simple solution that's never been tried before and is never, just like pure communism or pure socialism, it's never really been, tried. And then we got to push it through, and then, by golly, that's going to make things work out just fine. And I'm curious, as you're mentioning this, do you think – I remember writing in 2004 – about Howard Dean for National Review. And I was kind of surprised to find out that Howard Dean was, all things considered, a pretty pro-gun governor. At one point, I believe he was A-rated by the NRA.
I think you're right.
And this, wait a minute. This is, crazy screaming Howard Dean, the Democratic wing, the Democratic Party. He was, seen as very liberal, very progressive. And it said a lot more about the politics of the state of Vermont, where I'm pretty sure, if I'm remembering correctly from the article, a state legislator was going to introduce a bill that would have required every house in Vermont to have a firearm. It wasn't merely it's now gun required,
Right.
And the idea that it was so ingrained in the culture of Vermont that even though it's crunchy, happy land with Ben and Jerry's and very progressive in a whole bunch of ways, this was a state where the residents loved their guns and they were simply not hearing any of this gun control talk. So that Vermont, even though people think of it as the progressive version of New Hampshire, on the gun issue, Vermont was a very pro-gun. Now, a senator from Vermont doesn't set state policy. And a lot of people are kind of fuzzy on that concept as is. But the idea, I wonder if Hillary Clinton is trying to say, well, you know that Vermont is pro-gun, so Bernie Sanders must be pro-gun, even if his voting record in the Senate might, you know, suggest something very different there.
I think that, I think that there is something to that. And, you know, we saw this, like Hillary Clinton has come out and said Bernie Sanders is siding with gun manufacturers over the families of murdered children. Mm. So, you know, she's and by the way, I didn't see anybody on the left give Hillary a hard time. But when Bernie Sanders says Hillary Clinton is not qualified to be president, you take that back, Bernie Sanders. We could spend an entire couple of segments just talking about how the left is ignoring the fracturing within its own party because it's much more fun to cover the right. But, you know, so you've got the Vermont gun issue. By the way, there were, in 2014, 55 firearms recovered in New York State that were originally sold in Vermont. There were almost 1,400 firearms recovered in New York State that were originally sold in New York State. So this is not, you know, again, this is not the issue here. Then again, as I said, Hillary Clinton bashing Bernie Sanders for him saying that, you know, I don't think that you should hold a gun manufacturer responsible for what a criminal does, the criminal misuse of a firearm. Hillary Clinton apparently does. And we should tell you today that judge in the lawsuit case said it can go forward, that the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act does not preclude the legal argument from being made that the plaintiff's attorneys are making, which is that the AR-15 shouldn't be for sale to civilians because it is a military rifle. Again, the judge says this case can go forward. We'll be talking about this on tomorrow's program as well. But the judge says, look, Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act doesn't cover that legal argument. So the case can go forward. Doesn't mean that she's finds merit in the argument, but she just says that the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act doesn't cover that argument. Hillary Clinton really is, I guess, you know, coming down and saying, listen, I do think that you should hold manufacturers responsible for the criminal misuse of their product. Now, she doesn't want to hold, you know, Goldman Sachs responsible for bad mortgages that they bought, right? She doesn't want to.
Can't they paid?
Okay.
Right. I mean, like high six figures per speech. I mean, come on.
Right. I'm also curious, under the same theory, you know, look, violent crime is at 40-year lows in this country, by and large. Drug overdoses are at all-time high. Do you hold pharmaceutical companies accountable for overdoses of opioid-based pills when they know that a certain percentage of that product is going to end up in the hands of a drug abuser who is likely to, you know, overdose? Why under the theory that she has put forth, why would you not hold pharmaceutical companies accountable for drug overdoses?
Knowing the mentality of the left progressive activists and certain Democratic lawmakers, Cam.
I should not even say this at all.
Because they will, you know, the same approach to tobacco companies, the same approach to almost any industry that they demonize. If they could extort a settlement out of any industry for saying, look, whether or not you've done anything legally wrong, we are going to argue loudly that you have, and that these terrible things that have happened are your fault, even though all you did was make, you know, all you had the audacity was make painkillers and life-saving medicines for people, you bastards. You know, we're going to make the public hate you unless you give us a lot of money, and we'll use it to do good, happy things and stuff like that. You were mentioned, just to back a second ago, think about it, like in Bernie Sanders. You and I could make fun of him for a really long time. We have all kinds of disagreements. But does anybody really think that Bernie Sanders doesn't feel sympathy for families that have had victims of gun violence?
Right.
Does anybody think that anybody with any just ounce of human compassion? Like, so the idea that like Hillary Clinton is so much like a Terminator, right? I mean, like just when she sees a target that has to be destroyed, it has to be destroyed. And there's no depth she won't stoop to, right? Because think about it, this is someone she's theoretically eventually going to need the endorsement of, right? They're all going to need to hug it out at the convention. Everybody's supposed to go unified as Democrats. And I'm kind of struck by the fact that, like, once somebody has said, no, Bernie Sanders, you've chosen to stand opposed to, like, it's really a terrible thing to say about somebody. And they're going to be on the stage tonight. It'll be kind of fascinating to see. Does Sanders let his irritation with, and you know, I think we would argue justified irritation or anger about the show. Does he raise his voice? Is he capable of raising his voice? You know, like does he get outraged about this? Because we know his alleged suggestion that she's, you know, or his statement that she's not qualified. Now, when he says he's not, I've been in the Senate for 8 years. I've been Secretary of State. You know, the definition of qualifications, like in the middle of the Bush era Supreme Court fights, right? Mm-hmm. The argument for a long, you know, this is how Scalia was, it was, I believe, confirmed something like 98 to nothing. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was something like 97 to nothing or 97 to three. Like there used to be, no matter what your ideology was, if you were a good, solid judge, people voted for you. If you needed something like Clarence Thomas had the Anita Hill allegations, you know, Democrats said, okay, we're not going to vote for that. But by and large, everybody voted for a Supreme Court nominee if they were, to quote Senator Franken, good enough, smart enough, and doggone it, people liked them. We're now seeing the same application to, and then Chuck Schumer comes along and says, well, actually, it doesn't matter if you're experienced enough. It doesn't matter if you're considered a competent judge. Now we're going to use the criteria, are you going to make decisions that I like? And if you aren't, and by, you know, for obvious reasons, a judge nominated by a Republican president is not likely to make decisions that Chuck Schumer is going to like, I'm going to vote against you, right? And so that's kind of the take there. Well, now when Bernie Sanders goes through the issues I listed through in my you know, screaming in top of my lungs rant at the beginning of the segment, she voted for the Iraq War. She voted for trade deals. She took money from Wall Street. This disqualifies you. He doesn't mean, you know, like you and I might argue, you know,
constitutionally precluded.
Yeah,
what,
right. You
what he means is
you're unacceptable to me.
Yeah.
And you know there is a because if he really believes she
would have our own list, by the way.
Well, yeah. Are you on possibility of being indicted in the near future? You know, is it possible the FBI director is going to resign in protest over the refusal to indict you or something like that? Yeah, we Bernie, we can make that case for you if you want. For some strange reason, you've hesitated to do that. But he, you know, he's both of these Democrats are saying things, and you know, I don't think just necessarily the heat of the moment. I think they actually, you know, this doesn't seem like a pose. I think if you hooked up Bernie Sanders to a lie detector right now, he would pass the flying colors when he says, "I believe Hillary Clinton is not qualified to be president." And if you said to her, you know, do you think, you know, that Bernie Sanders, you know, chooses to stand with gun manufacturers over these families that are suffering and have lost a loved one? I think the technician would tell you, I can't get a good reading, a baseline on her, because she won't say anything that's true.
Talking again with our friend Jim Garrity from National Review. Why don't we take our final time out of the hour, at least until the end of the hour break. We will be back with more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. Gentlemen, welcome to NRA News.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Tell me, what is AmericanSnipers.org all about?
We're a nonprofit, totally volunteer. Nobody makes any money. But basically what we do is we raise money, we buy gear, and we send it to military snipers overseas to do the business that needs to be done.
And how did you start this?
In 2003, we're basically police snipers from around the country. There's a big, I guess, the community's very tight, but there's a wide spread of us. And a couple of us were being deployed as reservists and National Guard as snipers. They were also police snipers, and they needed gear that they didn't have available. So we put that together, started this little project, raised a little bit of money, and then realized there was a big need. And that was 2003. We've since grown legs, and here we are 14 years later, still raising money, sending gear to snipers in country.
So, Ron, going from where you guys started in 2003 to now, what's the trip been like? How has it grown? What's happened?
Well, it's been quite an adventure for us, but a lot of the needs have not really changed. The sniper units only have so much money, so once that money runs out, the guys are doing without. So we're still providing things, mostly sniper-specific gear, like rangefinders, spotting scopes, rifle scopes, gun cleaning gear, binoculars, that kind of thing. And it's the type of gear, like Dave said, when guys are getting deployed, they would call back home and they're asking mom and dad, hey, can you pick me up a wind meter? Well, folks don't generally know where to get that kind of stuff, but we do. So that's why they come to us, and we're able to get them their specific gear that they need.
Speak with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. All right, so you guys start this. It's a no-brainer to me. It's a great idea and a great service you're all doing. What's the reaction rolling this out in the sniper community?
We have, when people know what we're doing, all they want to do is help. And where they can help us is we raise money. We sell swag. We sell coins and little trinkets. People give and donate. The manufacturers donate. But for the most part, people hear about it and they go, that's awesome. I'm upset we have to do that, but yeah, we want to help them.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned that, David. Ron, what do you guys think about, and I don't want to get political, but what do you think about that? It's got to be frustrating to officers to know that sometimes they can't get the support they need to get the equipment that they need.
I don't think that's ever going to change. I think as long as we have a bureaucracy that has budgets and budgets get tight, we're not going to always be able to get the things we need. We know that as police officers. We know that as the military. There's priorities. And the bottom line is, as American citizens, we're going to support our military. And when people recognize that and we can broad stroke share that, they want to be part of that.
That's cool. Once again, speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org, you know, there's a lot of folks who don't understand what it is, the mindset, the mentality, the life of a sniper, whether it's a military or police. Ron, what can you tell people about how can they understand best what you guys are, what you go through, you know, help get inside your head?
Well, it's just a very specialized thing that we do. It's something that people volunteer for, but you also have to have the right mindset and the determination and the professionalism to go through that. It's not for everybody, and not everybody gets to do it, but it's a very special thing, and guys who earn that spot, we try and help them out by doing what we do.
All right, it's a big sacrifice. Normally, military police, you're sacrificing.
Right, so give us an idea of some of the people that you've helped and who've benefited from AmericanSnipers.org.
Without naming names, it's been hundreds of guys in all different branches of the service. So we're at events like this. We get approached by people and said, hey, in 2004, you sent us a bunch of gear. You really helped us out. We hear from parents. So that's what we get out of it. That's what we find fulfilling.
Gentlemen, I bet you that never gets old either, right?
No,
not at all.
Not at all. Not at all. And then some of the gear that we get or we get donated, we get to give that back to the manufacturers. We had a company that donated some knives.
Tell folks how they get more information about AmericanSnipers.org.
Well, you can go to our website at www.AmericanSnipers.org, and that's where they can donate. We always have gun raffles going on constantly of some pretty high-end guns that we get donated to us.
David, Ron, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being part of NRA News.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Jim Garrity from National Review in studio with us. David Arsani of The Federalist, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins next hour. In hour three, Richard Grinnell from the Coalition for More Civil Liberties, and Kurt Schlichter, the author of Conservative Insurgency and Too Many Columns to Mention by Name. You will be joining us in Louisville, Kentucky once again.
I am. Next month. I'm looking forward to that. I extend my colleague, Charlie Cook, frequent guest on this program, will also be down there. And we had a pretty decent turnout of kind of the conservative blogging crew back in Nashville, and I'm hoping to see a similar turnout this time.
I think it's going to be a good one. Mm. I will tell you that. We're starting to see some names released for the Celebration of American Values Leadership Forum. Our friend Katie Pavlich is going to be speaking.
Ooh,
right?
Good for her. All right.
I know. It's always cool when you go from covering the event to speaking at it.
You know,
that's a big deal. You know that with CPAC. Blogger of the Year.
Yeah.
Or, I'm sorry, Journalist of the Year, right?
Yes. Yes, Journalist of the Year. 2015. And here's I didn't hear who got it last time at this most recent CPAC, and no one I Googled it, couldn't find it. So I'm starting to think
you're just the standing one.
I don't know if it's like Miss America or like if for some reason, you know. But then the next thing is that, you know, there's two ways of doing it. I love looking at it. Either I set the bar so high, no one could, you know, we can't put anybody up, you know. no one's lived up to Jim this past year. Or he ruined it, and there's no point in giving this award anymore. It's completely discredited. It's a disaster. So
we were talking about Hillary and Bernie, and I said I'm sure that you picked up on this phenomenon as well. The media, most of whom are, I would say, ideologically supporting Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, they really are not interested in talking as much about the ideological divide in the Democratic Party. There is a fracturing going on in the Democratic Party. This was supposed to be a coronation for Hillary Clinton. It is not. She's lost eight straight primaries. And I do think she's going to win New York, but she's lost eight straight primaries, Jim. By the way, while she's been touting her anti-gun credentials and Bernie Sanders is a rotten person, it hasn't really seemed to matter to Democratic primary voters. Now, that's, you know, look, I mean, that's going to be your most likely our audience who will be supportive of these anti-gun measures. It hasn't moved the needle even within the Democratic base for Hillary.
Real Clear Politics is one of my favorite sites for just look, you know, they collect all the polls and they do a pretty good job of aggregating them, meaning putting them together into charts, and you can see how things change. The good news for Hillary Clinton, look, she remains the most likely Democratic nominee. She's been the front runner almost entirely all along. And you look at her support, her floor of support is probably above 50% amongst the Democrats. That's a good thing to be, because you can never really lose if you have that floor of support. The good news is the ceiling isn't that much high either. And you actually look at her line of support actually has been in that 50 to 55% pretty steadily. And what happened was is that Bernie Sanders is slowly creeping up, and that undecided amount is shrinking over time. And if you look in their chart, he's almost caught her. He's been between 40 and 49%. I'd say I don't have the chart in front of me, but about the last 2 weeks, and it's been the steady diagonal straight line. Is he probably going to overtake her? Probably not, because her support's not shakable. But basically, primary after primary, week after week, month after month, she's trying to close. This is all, by the way, national polling, not state by state polling.
Okay.
Trying to close the sale, and it's not closing, and people are jumping onto the Bernie bandwagon. Now, again, this is, you know, of that plurality of people who haven't decided or are in between the two of them. You mentioned his winning streak, and even when he loses, because it's a two-person campaign, he's ending up with like 45% of the vote in most of these states, right? He's going to end with I thought from the very beginning he's probably going to get about 40% of the total vote in the Democratic primary. That's nothing to sneeze at. That's a very, you know, when you go into this, the giant underdog that Bernie Sanders was,
ask Martin O'Malley.
any one of the other Democrats who, you know, amounted to really nothing. You know, Bernie Sanders became the alternative. And it turns out Democrats were very eager to explore alternatives because, let's face it, you know, that basically since midsummer 2008, Hillary Clinton has been the most likely person to be the successor to Barack Obama. Now here we are. This is he basically has come along and said, look, this party is too corporate. It's too friendly to Wall Street. We need a political revolution. We need a nonviolent political revolution. You and I in a conversation that could go on much longer than the listeners probably have the patience for. The Sanders campaign is an expression of liberal disappointment with Barack Obama. Because you and I remember 2007, 2008, man, Obama was, Oprah was telling us he was the one, right?
Light worker.
The light worker, people chanting, they're supposed to make that O sign and all that stuff. Ashton Kutcher and Demi Moore, but pledging to Barack Obama. You know, this was a.
Yeah, the songs, the kids singing the songs.
Full-fledged cult of personality. And people really thought that he, you know, this great, you know, like there was a disturbingly ubiquitous discussion of Barack Obama as a leader in religious terms. I don't just mean as a leader, like as a divine leader, like sent to us by God. Well, here we are. You know, how'd that work out? And most liberals, if you either inject them with sodium pentothal or get it drunk enough, or even I think it was Bill Press has a interesting book out that basically is about the disappointment with Obama. He's a down-the-line liberal. And I read through it, and most of it's, you know, well, those mean Republicans would let him do what he wanted, but Obama should have fought back harder and stuff like that. But they're acknowledging. Nobody feels like we're living in an era of great prosperity. Sure, Obama got us out of Iraq, but there's this thing called ISIS that has come along. And you know, right before the show, you and I were talking about Obama's South American trip, which the American president is standing in front of the giant mural of Che
Mm-hmm. And apparently picked that out. Let's use that as the backdrop.
Cool. You said you were a wee bit miffed over his statement that, you know, capitalism, communism, pick whatever works for you, right? You know,
yeah,
that they were kind of indistinguishable, that you really shouldn't, you know, get tied up in these ideological divides. But I think the one that just kind of struck me was the tango. It was down in Argentina. This was the day of the Brussels bombing, mm-hmm. where the capital city of NATO is on lockdown and people are dying and all that stuff. And, you know, Cam, you know, before we wrote our excellent book, Heavy Lifting, which is available from Amazon and, you know, fine bookstores everywhere, I wrote The Weed Agency, which was a fictional, it was a novel, but it was a highly realistic novel about this fictional agency to illuminate how government works, or more specifically, how the federal bureaucracy doesn't work. And throughout it, you may remember, and I remember you objecting to it, I put lots of footnotes in it, because every time I said something that seemed too ridiculous to be real, I wanted the reader to say, actually, no, this is totally true. This is based on something that happened back in 80-something or 70-something or something like that. And if I had written a book in which this liberal Democrat American president gives his first comments about a serious terrorist attack at a baseball game in Havana, Cuba, while holding a beer, wearing sunglasses, and he's got a cigar, right? You know, and he gives his first comments on this bombing to ESPN, and he doesn't act like this is a particularly big deal. And then later that day, or within a day, he goes to Argentina, and a woman, not his wife, invites him onto the tango dance floor, and he dances the tango in Argentina. He's literally dancing while our allies are under attack. People would have said, Jim, that's ridiculous. It's over the top. It's, this is agitprop. This is, no American president would ever do that. And then we watched it, right? So this has not been a successful presidency. And I think if you really push, you know, Democrats on this, they'll admit it, that they're not where they thought they were going to be after two terms of Barack Obama. They thought it would be better than this. And they're looking for some, why not? What went wrong? And then some of them will return to hating the Republicans. That's always been kind of this, like, Linus's security blanket, mm-hmm. something that kind of reassures them. It's been interesting how much Wall Street has become the villain of choice, big business. But, you know, somebody's got more money than you, and they're the reason.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. I watched The Big Short. A couple of weeks ago. Have you seen that yet?
I've not. I've seen the trailers. You know.
It's okay. So it did take me. I fell asleep halfway through, I'll be honest with you. And then it picked up. Mm-hmm. I did end up finishing it, and it was good, but it was a very incomplete picture of what happened with the mortgage meltdown. It focused on the Wall Street side of things. That mm-hmm. aha, you know what? We can bundle these high risk mortgages all together. We can turn these risky mortgages into AAA rated bonds. Mm-hmm. But they never really talked about why we were seeing so many of these risky mortgages in the first place. And so a few weeks ago, and by the way, a lot of that was from the government telling these banks, you know what? You're not lending to poor people. You're not lending. We want to create an ownership society, and Bush was part of this as well.
As Barney Frank said, I want to roll the dice a little more with this.
Right. And they rolled and
came up snake eyes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so now I saw a couple of weeks ago a story of Barack Obama's administration is telling banks, because they're telling banks, you're not lending to people with lower credit scores. What's going on here?
You kind of wish the banks would say, because we don't think they're going to pay it back.
Well, they have. Actually have said that. Yeah. And this is the response of our government. Don't worry about it. You're not on the hook. We're on the hook for it. You, the banks, you don't have any financial risk here.
Do you?
The government assumes the risk. Now, Jim,
do you feel like Bill Murray?
No, I feel like reference here. I feel like the guy in Network who, you know, raises the wind. Yeah. I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it. You know, I do feel a little bit like Groundhog Day. Here we have the government saying, you know, 8 years after Too Big to Fail, we still have that stupid phrase going around. In fact, there was I think it was MetLife. Court said, nope, they're not too big to fail. Government comes back and says, no, they're too big to fail. There's no such thing as too big to fail. And there is this assumption that the government is too big to fail. Look at the government of Venezuela right now. Mm-hmm. Biggest thing going in the country of Venezuela. It ain't too big to fail.
Yeah. You know, this is no toilet paper. right? You know.
Everybody's taking off on Fridays now for the foreseeable future in an attempt to try to keep the lights on in Venezuela because they don't have enough money. You know, you can only disregard basic financial principles for so long before karma comes back and bites you.
You know, Cam, you and I we undoubtedly have our flaws. Readers of Heavy Lifting. Readers of Heavy Lifting might say, I've spotted that one, you know. but we like to think of ourselves, like, we, whatever our flaws are, we like to think we're not in denial, right? I mean, we try to see the world as it is. And there are probably, like, I'd like to think the Jets have a chance to win the Super Bowl. The evidence suggests that if you don't have a starting quarterback, it would help, you know, things like that.
Sure.
So we're capable of making mistakes, but we're not totally in denial. It seems like as you're describing this phenomenon of, no, make the loans, it's going to turn out fine. Like, that's denial, mm-hmm. right? That is a refusal to learn lessons of what just happened. I want to cite a story about,
about 15 seconds to cite it, by the way. We're running out of time.
Anyway, my new slogan, having watched so many people running around in denial about politics, is now reality always wins. Sometimes it's ugly, sometimes it's messy, but eventually reality will intrude and it wins.
Well, thank you for not making that slogan reality bites. And welcome to the winter of our discontent. Jim Garrity from National Review, thank you so much. It's good to see you in studio. We'll do this again soon. Hour 2 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Noslers. Coming up next, David Ersani of The Federalist, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins with Breitbart. We'll be back with more right after this quick timeout.
Speaking with Joe Fiala with the South Dakota Governor's Office of Economic Development. Joe, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Hey, I'm great, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for stopping by. You got a lot of stuff going on. I wanted you to talk a little bit about what you do in the Governor's Office of Economic Development there in South Dakota and why you do it. So tell us a little bit about what the office is all about and what you have going on.
Sure. So we're all about growing business in the state or attracting business to the state. And in my specific instance, I get to work with all of the companies in the shooting, hunting, and outdoor industry. So everything from firearms and ammunition to duck calls and fishing rods.
Wow, Joe, can we say dream job here?
Yeah, you can.
And it's great in South Dakota. There's an office to do this. Because, you know, Joe, in sort of, and some states would say, I won't mention names, you know, it's okay. Maybe we'll keep you at arm's length. We love your taxes, but you guys are showing in a very overt way here, welcoming industries like this.
Absolutely. You know, it's such a good fit for the state in a couple of ways. And here's a couple of examples. We've got about 850,000 people in the state. And we issued 350,000 hunting licenses last year.
Say that again. Hold on.
Yeah. So we've got about 850,000 people in the state, and we issued 350,000 hunting licenses.
Wow, dude, that is incredible.
Yeah. So this industry is a really good fit for the state. It's just culturally what we do, who we are.
Yeah, and you know, Joe, we're talking. Let's talk about that for a minute. I just was talking with some other folks here, and for people who are non-hunters and don't understand, it's part of a lifestyle. You know, it's part of, you know, who we are and what we do.
That's exactly right. You know, I grew up hunting with my dad and my mom, and we'd go out hunting, and now I get to teach my kids that same thing.
Right.
And it's about family time. It's about hunting for your table.
Yeah.
In some instances.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's about the sportsmanship.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, Joe, whether you grew up, I grew up in Pennsylvania. Hunting's big there. The day after Thanksgiving, when I grew up, it wasn't about going out Black Friday and shopping. It was going out deer hunting.
Exactly.
Or you grew up in South Dakota. That's just part of what our DNA is. Speaking with Joe Fiala, he is with the South Dakota Governor's Office of Economic Development. So tell us a little bit about some of the stuff, some of the folks who you've been working with. Name some of the companies.
Right. So, you know, some of the South Dakota companies that have been longtime residents that continue to grow. You hear Dakota Arms.
Right.
Certainly, Black Hills Ammunition.
Absolutely.
Corbin Ammunition. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've got some of the players that have been around a long time. One of our newest corporate citizens to the state is a company out of Pennsylvania. It's called Lehigh Defense.
Okay,
They are expanding to the state. And so it's a great fit. They're going to make bullets. and we'll use them.
So how great is that? A company in Pennsylvania is expanding out to South Dakota.
Right.
How great is that?
Right.
All right, so we got about 30 seconds here, and then we have to wrap it up. So I want you to sort of give folks the message why they need to be, if they're in those particular industries you mentioned before, why do they need to bring their business to South Dakota?
Sure. Couple of things. One, we're a very low-tax state, which means we want the business owner to keep their money. Okay.
That's nice.
Yeah. Second thing is Forbes rated us number one as the lowest cost of business state in 2015.
That's nice, too.
Right. So it doesn't cost a lot to do business. And then the cultural fit that we talked about, it just works. And we want to grow that business in our state.
How can people get more information about what you do?
Right. They can go to our website. It's sdreadytowork.com.
Okay.
And then for my specific industry, you put a slash and shot.
Joe, thanks so much for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
You bet. Thanks, John.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. David Arsani writing at the Federalist says the Obama administration now apologizing for America winning World War II. Sure. Why not? Apologize for everything else. Dr. Anna Muir Hawkins of Breitbart on some of the most infamous gun grabbers out there. Plus, coming up next hour, Richard Grenell joining us from the Coalition for More Civil Liberties. The group had launched an online campaign, signature gathering campaign, opposed to this anti-gun referendum, which appears likely to be on the ballot there in California in November. And the campaign was pulled by Twitter. There was a story in the Daily Caller quoting somebody at Twitter talking about bad business practices. Anyway, soon after this story went up from the Daily Caller, the questions began, and Richard Grenell tweeted out maybe like within an hour or so of this story going live that the campaign was back up and running on Twitter. But is this now a part of how things get done? Not only do you have to stand up and fight for what you believe in, but you stand up and you have to fight for to be heard about what you believe in. There's that extra additional step there, apparently, online. Kurt Schlichter will join us on the program as well, coming up in hour three. I mentioned, we were talking with Jim Garrity last hour. I talked a little bit about the debate tonight in Brooklyn, New York. The New York Post says that the Democratic primary has veered into fantasy land, with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders hitting hard on issues far removed from reality. Talking about Clinton's doubling down on her silly claim that guns from Vermont pose a dire threat to New Yorkers' safety. Now, here's where the New York Post, I think, gets it wrong a little bit, or at least is a little selective in their facts. They say, with extremely creative statistics to obscure the fact that far more illegal firearms arrive here from Virginia, which is a lot farther off. Yeah, there are also more firearms recovered again in New York State with a New York sale than Virginia and Vermont combined. But the Post doesn't talk about that. The Post does say, never mind the fact that New Yorkers on the Vermont border share Granite Staters' views on guns. That's why Senator Kristen Gillibrand, back when she was an upstate congresswoman, was an avid gun rights supporter. Yeah, but it's not just New Yorkers on the Vermont border. It's a lot of upstate New York. And there's a lot to upstate New York. And the signs in the yards opposed to the New York Safe Act, which was passed 3 years ago, they're still there. The voters who called their state senators, who called their assembly person, who talked with their local elected sheriffs about the SAFE Act, they're still concerned about this. The law enforcement, who were opposed to the passage of the SAFE Act because they saw this as efforts aimed in the wrong direction, they're still opposed to it. And they'll tell you it hasn't helped them go after criminals because it was aimed at law-abiding gun owners. The New York Post also says, New Yorkers must be made to fear the phantom Vermont gun menace
so that Senator Palpatine or Clinton can continue her rise to power. And then they talk about Bernie Sanders and his opposition to fracking. The Post says it's a shame a week before both campaigns were hitting hard on real issues. Bernie slamming Hillary over the million she's been paid by Wall Street, while Hillary hit Bernie on his apparent cluelessness as to just how he delivered on his wild promises to break up the big banks and so on. The Post editorial board says it's almost as if they agreed to shift to phony attacks because the truth was hurting too much. No, I doubt that was it. Almost, maybe, but not quite. You know, again, Hillary Clinton is trying to find some daylight between her and Bernie Sanders that doesn't involve her support for Wall Street. And gun control is one of those issues where she thinks she can make a play, which is why we are seeing this. Now, I am curious to see tonight in the debate. I don't know if I'll actually watch it live because I might have something better to do, like paint my toenails or something like that. But I am curious to see during the debate tonight. Bernie Sanders is not going to stand up for the Second Amendment. I'll tell you that right now. If you're tuning in expecting to see some, you know, full-throated defense of the right to keep and bear arms, you're not going to get it. The debate is being held in Brooklyn. And this is, I think, an attempt for Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton to try to out-anti-gun each other. Bernie Sanders, I think you'd be much more likely to hear Bernie Sanders say, listen, Hillary says that I'm siding with the gun lobby, that I side with these gun manufacturers. Let me tell you what I think about these gun manufacturers. Let me tell you what I think about. I think you're much more likely to get that. But the fact remains that in state after state where Hillary Clinton has tried to make this an issue among the Democratic base, it hasn't been. It has not won her any of the last eight caucuses or primaries. Even states like Wisconsin, where she devoted a lot of time and resources to trying to differentiate herself on the basis of gun control. I do think that she'll win New York State. And maybe she'll win New York State with the help of anti-gun advocates in New York City. But I can tell you, Tom King, head of the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, will tell you. There are a lot of sheriffs there in upstate New York who will tell you that the SAFE Act and the emphasis, again, on going after the law-abiding gun owner as opposed to the violent criminal, this is something that is not a very appealing point of view to a lot of New Yorkers there. Now, down in the Lone Star State of Texas, we have been talking with our friend Antonio Okafor with Students for Concealed Carry about the many policies that are being implemented and developed. Basically, every university system there in the state of Texas gets to come out with their own recommendations. The law goes into effect on August the 1st. Texas A&M, it's another big system, they have come out with their policy recommendations. The system's 9-member Board of Regents will consider the proposals on April 27th. They can approve or amend them. Those concealed carry holders will be allowed to carry in class and on dormitories on every Texas A&M University campus, according to the Dallas Morning News. The system's new campus carry information page says, no rule proposed by any Texas A&M system member prohibits a license holder from carrying a concealed handgun in classrooms or residential facilities owned and operated or leased and operated by the institution. Three campuses, Prairie View, Corpus Christi, Texas A&M International, and Laredo, they have dorms that are run privately and not by the school, and the system says that the gun policies in those residences will be determined by the independent management company. There are also four other universities within the A&M system there in Texas that under these proposals, and this is at Texas A&M Commerce, Texas A&M Texarkana, Texas A&M San Antonio, and Texas A&M in College Station, staff would be allowed to petition the campus presidents to ban guns in their office if they could prove that the presence of a gun would lead to, quote, significant risk of substantial harm. Now, the Dallas Morning News talked with the Texas A&M University spokesman Lane Stevenson. He did not elaborate on how a professor would have to demonstrate, saying that, quote, our position is that it's premature to discuss our campus carry proposal prior to consideration by the Board of Regents. The president, Michael K. Young, said yesterday that the university's campus carry task force at first suggested allowing staff to request gun bans in their private offices. He changed his proposal. He said he supported that recommendation, but he changed the proposal to the Board of Regents, quote, after discussion with the A&M system legal counsel as well as advice from the Office of the Attorney General of Texas. Nan Palmero, marketing manager at Texas A&M University San Antonio, said their office policy is still being finalized. It would be decided on a case-by-case basis. The Dallas Morning News points out only the University of Texas at Austin has proposed allowing faculty to ban guns in their private offices without having to demonstrate that there is a unique need to do so. And there are apparently two more institutions there in the Lone Star State of Texas that have not yet issued their campus carry recommendations. You've still got Texas Southern University and the University of Houston Victoria that have not yet determined what their policies will be. Again, this is going into effect on August the 1st, so we expect those proposals to be out of here before long. Meanwhile, in Washington State, Michael Bloomberg, who was behind the funding for a universal background check referendum a couple of years ago, is back at it, chipping in $500,000 for a new proposal called the Washington State Extreme Risk Protection Order. This would establish extreme risk protection orders in Washington, allowing families and law enforcement to ask the courts to issue a temporary restriction on an individual's right to keep and bear arms. So the same group that brought you the quote-unquote universal background check bill in 2014, the Alliance for Gun Responsibility, is behind this latest measure. Why they didn't do this back in 2014, I don't know, but they're at it again now. The proposal would allow a family member to file a petition with the court for a judge to decide if the person poses a threat to themselves or others, which could lead to a order prohibiting firearms possession for up to a year and could actually be renewed every year after that. The subject of the order could request a hearing once a year to rescind the order. Those filing false petitions would set themselves up for a criminal penalty, hypothetically. Huh. Every town's Gun Safety Action Fund has ponied up $500,000 to help promote this proposal. It is, by the way, it's so easy, such a simple proposal, that it's 21 pages to read. Be it enacted by the people of the state of Washington, and then 21 pages worth of legalese. You know, we've seen ballot initiatives, pro-gun ballot initiatives around the country. Particularly, you know, you look at like the amendment to the state constitutions that we've seen. Protecting the right to hunt and fish, right? I got to tell you, those don't come with like 40 pages of small print. They don't. It's basically, should we add the following language to the state constitution? And it's generally that, you know, no law should be made that would restrict or infringe on the right to lawfully hunt and fish and trap in accordance with state law and with you know, responsible game practices. That's it. There's no asterisk that follows, no Latin phrases you have to go translate. It's just the clear, simple language. Not going to get that in Washington State. Now you're going to get it in California either, with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom's anti-gun proposals. And it's only April. We also, we could see more states. Actually, we know we're going to see more states with anti-gun referendums on the ballot, because in Nevada, the quote-unquote universal background check bill, that is going to be question one on the ballot in Nevada in November. Question two is, should we legalize marijuana in the state of Nevada? Should we have the universal background checks, though? That is going to be the number one question for voters there in the Silver State. And I would not be surprised. Actually, you know, I keep thinking about other states here. In Maine, every town in Bloomberg pushing for that exact same measure to be on the ballot again this November. So Michael Bloomberg and the anti-gun activists, they have been saying for quite some time, this is the year. It's okay to be anti-gun. They've been saying Al Gore made a mistake in running from his votes. And the Democratic Party made a mistake in running from Al Gore and from running from gun control, for trying to build up that that blue dog Democrat coalition, for trying to have Democratic candidates who are pro-gun. The party made a mistake. Bloomberg is saying, no, no, no. These gun owners are paper tigers. They don't really matter. They don't really have an impact on elections. Now, keep in mind, they keep proving him wrong, but this is his pitch. This is his spiel to the candidates. You don't have to be concerned about voters who are gun owners. You don't have to be concerned about voters who support the Second Amendment. There aren't that many of them out there. And, you know, they really don't even all vote all that often. But what I can give you, A, is a ton of cash. I can also give you organizational support. We've got our own grassroots army of anti-gun activists, and they'll turn out and they'll vote for you, just like the NRA members are going out and voting for the candidates who support the Second Amendment. Don't be afraid to run on an outspoken record of gun control. That's what he's telling the candidates. He wants to buttress that with, again, these referendums, put them on the ballot in states where he thinks that voters might be amenable, to try to build, at this point, not even a substantial track record of real success, but to build up the narrative of success. Remember when the campaign by Moms Demand Action was to try to convince, like, every business in America to ban concealed carry? They didn't do that. In fact, most of the companies that they went to and said, you need to ban concealed carry, they didn't ban concealed carry at all. The most that Moms Demand Action ever really got was we would like to ask people not to bring their firearms into our stores. But if you do, of course, we're going to continue to serve you. We're not going to put up the signs or anything like that. That was the most that they got. And every one of those requests that Moms Demand Action was able to get out of a company, they treated like that was a huge victory for them. Why? Not because they're delusional, but because they were wanting to set and build a narrative of success. We're seeing the same thing here in 2016 with both the elections of anti-gun candidates and, again, the ballot initiatives that are popping up around the country as well. All right, stick around. When we come back after a quick timeout, David Ossanyi, writing at The Federalist, says the Obama administration is now apologizing for America winning World War II. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Speaking with Bill Poole, he is Managing Director, NRA Education and Training Division. Bill, let's talk about the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course. I understand some of it's now available online. Tell us about it.
Yes, John. It's called blended learning. That means that part of the course is online. It's about a 7.5-hour online training section that students can complete in the comforts of their own home on their own schedule. And then once they've completed the online or the e-learning module, then they can contact an NRA-certified instructor who will take them to the range and check out their skills, make sure their safe gun handling is at its top, and that their marksmanship skills are just as good as it needs to be.
So this is the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course, which is, Bill, such a great course and such a great thing. You guys have kind of jiggered things up a little bit there to make it easier for people to do, right?
It is easier, but I don't want anybody to think that that means that it's shorter or less comprehensive. It's about 7.5 hours of seat time when you take the e-learning module, and then about another 5 hours of time when you go shooting. But the good news is the shooting portion can be all done in one day, in half a day, and so it's going to meet the needs of our students' schedules much better than we've been able to do in the past.
I love it. So then get the book learning part done, then get out there to the range with an NRA certified instructor and finish it all up. It's a great idea, this blended learning course. So, Bill, how can folks get more information about this? How can they sign up? How do they do it?
First step is go to our webpage. It's onlinetraining.nra.org, and I hope they all do it today.
Why should folks check out the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course?
It is one of the most vibrant, robust e-learning training courses they're ever going to encounter. There's video, there are 3D pictures. You can listen to it. You can read it. I mean, we've used every modality teachers know how to use. It's an excellent course.
Could have said it better myself, Bill Pohl. Thank you so much, sir.
I'm a mom, a business owner, and a patriot, but I am not a politician. A few years ago, I founded a nonprofit to defend voters' rights and stop election fraud. We exposed corruption, so the corruptors wanted me silenced. The IRS, FBI, ATF, OSHA, and a U.S. congressman turned my life upside down. Their investigations were invasive, abusive, relentless, and political. They demanded every social media message I'd ever posted, the name of every group I'd ever spoken to, and every word I spoke. I was supposed to give up. But I am not a victim. I'm an American, and I will not stand by and watch while our freedoms are picked off. An attack on one right is an attack on every right. So, I fight. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I want a woman president, but I want an honest president more. I want someone who can place their hand on a Bible and swear to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution without telling a lie. Someone who believes in the integrity of that office. A president whose actions reinforce the moral lessons I teach my children. There are many powerful, accomplished women in both parties who meet and exceed that standard. But you, Mrs. Clinton, are not one of them. Your past is littered with shameful, dishonest behavior. Decades of decisions that point toward your own power and fortune, not the best interest of women, the country, or the truth. There is no greater threat to my freedom than another dishonest president. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, and the music of the early 1990s. It sounded happier back then, didn't it, Cameron? Like, there were no problems. You just roll with me. Roll to me. That's all. Everybody was just so shiny and happy back then. Now, not so much. David Arsani, right anti-federalist with us on the program. How you doing, David?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Absolutely. Glad you could join us. And so this piece... the Obama administration is now apologizing for America winning World War II. I saw it prompted quite a bit of discussion online, and it's, obviously some folks disagree with your premise here.
Right. I mean, I think there are two questions. I will right here admit that the headline's a slight bit clickbaity, but because Obama has not yet apologized, though I have to say, so Dana Perino retweeted that column, and it was mentioned at a White House briefing. and they asked about it. And from what I heard, it sounds to me like if he's not going to just overtly apologize for Hiroshima, that it's definitely something that's being discussed pretty seriously.
Oh, really? So, like, this wasn't, the response from the White House wasn't, that's preposterous. Why would we ever apologize for that? It was
no, different. It was more like whatever he decides to do, you know, he's thought it through like he always does because he's super, you know, calm, cool, and collected. So, but anyway, so, I mean, there are a bunch of people who think we should apologize because they believe that it was immoral to drop the bomb. And there's a bunch of people who are angry because I am pointing out that the Obama administration does a lot of euphemistic apologizing, you know, acknowledging things that we did and blaming nuclear weapons rather than sort of the fanatical regime that was over there at the time. You know, so they were pointing out that the headline was unfair.
Okay, but the, and again, as you say, it looks like the White House doesn't necessarily think that the headline is particularly unfair, maybe a little premature.
Mm-hmm.
But the crux of your column is that John Kerry goes over to Japan, becomes the first Secretary of State to visit Hiroshima, tour in the Peace Memorial, the museum. And he talked about everything other than the fact that Japan had declared war on the United States, and this was an awful period in history, and there were a lot of awful things that were done, and let's hope that we never have to go through anything like that again. That wasn't what we heard.
Right. Now, there were no cameras allowed, I don't, for the inside part, to take pictures of him doing this. This is just a comment he made, and he talked about nuclear weapons and how we should want to rid the world of them. Well, listen, I'm for peace as well, but I think without nuclear weapons, World War II would have gone on a lot longer. A lot of people would have died, Japanese and Americans, who didn't have to. But more than that, even, I think it's fair to say, even though a lot of people don't like this, that nuclear weapons have sort of, because they're so horrifying, have stopped the sort of conventional warfare we saw every 20, 30 years in Europe and elsewhere from happening, and probably saved lives as well. So it's sort of simplistic, sort of residual stuff from the 60s that people still throw out there. I mean, it'd be nice if we could put it all back in the bottle, but it doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, it's interesting. As I was reading your piece and was looking at some of the responses back and forth, I thought about jumping in. I think you were engaging with Lucy Steigerwald. And I thought about jumping in because my dad, who will be 90 this year, he was in on a destroyer off the coast of Japan. And just a few years ago, David, he opened up to me and we started talking about his experiences in World War II. He was a young guy. He was 17, when he dropped out of high school and enlisted in the Navy. And he said, I still have nightmares about what I saw off the coast of Okinawa because I could see the shelling. And I'm not going to share my dad's exact stories, but, you know, this has stayed with him for 70 years. The horrors that he saw have not gone away. And what he saw was a very, very small part of World War II. I don't think that there's honestly any way that anybody who wasn't living through that can really understand the questions and the answers that that people came to back then in terms of defending this nation and wanting to stop that war.
Right. I mean, you know, I'll read a book about World War II and their battles in the Pacific that, frankly, I never even heard of, and then I see 20, 30,000 people died in them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's just the immensity of how many, you know, the horror and the carnage and the death is just amazing. So, we you know, people should view it from that context in the sense that they should view it as something that happened then, not today, and the world was a different place. But, you know, I think I might not have mentioned this in the column, but can you imagine, though, so in Tokyo, when they did the fire bombings, they killed more people than Hiroshima, but yet no one ever talks about that. But imagine John Kerry going to Europe, to Dresden or Hamburg, and saying, you know, we're sorry about, you know, what happened to Germany in the Nazi regime, you know, that we had to bomb here and that we apologize. They would never do it. It's just it's nuclear weapons themselves, I think, that is the reason we're even talking about an apology. And personally, I think America did the right thing, and I wouldn't want that to happen today. We have better technology, but at the time, we wanted to stop a war, and I don't think Truman was out to kill Japanese. I think he wanted to stop the war. So, you know, we can never know for sure, but for me, it seemed like the more moral choice.
You know, and again, I don't think there were any easy choices back then. That's the other luxury that we have here, right? We can quarterback from 70 years later said, well, here's what I would have done. And you really don't know what you would have done. And you don't know what, you know, again, you look at the lives that the government was prepared to lose in an invasion of the Japanese mainland. And it puts D-Day, it makes D-Day seem like nothing, like a minor skirmish. You know, they were prepared to have to take every acre of land on the Japanese mainland because the Japanese had said, we will fight to the last man. The government was, telling its citizens, be prepared to fight. Didn't matter if you had a gun or not. Use a pole if you have to. But we expect you, if we are invaded, we expect you to fight and die. We don't expect you to surrender.
Right. And if we look at the other battles in the Pacific, you know that they meant it, right?
Yep.
It wasn't, to the last man. So it was going to be extremely bloody, and a lot of people were going to lose their lives. But you're definitely right. God, can you imagine having to make a choice like that? I wouldn't be able to make a choice about that, you know, if it involved three people, much less, you know, hundreds of thousands. So it's horrifying, but it is what it is, and it happened. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not one of these people who says America never needs to apologize for anything. I think we've done plenty of things that are wrong. But in the 20th century, I think generally our intentions were very good. And Hiroshima specifically bugs me because I think the left has always wanted to apologize for it for a very long time.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, at least as long as I can remember, there's been a certain segment of the left anyway that has felt the need to apologize, that has felt that we somehow did something wrong, and that we, because of the Manhattan Project, that we were the ones that sort of, you know, launched the world towards nuclear weapons, and it would have almost as if, like, if we didn't do it, David, then no other country,
right,
would have developed nuclear technology. You know, Einstein would have just kept it all to himself. There would have been no physicists that would have, you know, tried to push the boundaries here. This just all would have remained this sort of undiscovered science forever and ever if it weren't for the awful United States.
And what happens if someone else has it first, and how does history look then? I think very different. So I'm happy that we had it first, and it was no accident that we did, obviously. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, people think that this sort of technology, I mean, people knew that this could be done, and it was a race to get it done. And obviously we had the resources and the sort of the people to do it. But, I would suggest people read The Making of the Atomic Bomb by Richard Rhodes. It's an amazing book about this. But, here's the bigger picture, though. Why do we even have to involve ourselves in this sort of discussion about apologies? Well, I don't want the Japanese to apologize. I'm over it. We're over it. No one cares in that sense anymore. So it just seems like a weird discussion, and to constantly have it with Obama, because every time he leaves this country and goes somewhere, he's creating some moral equivalence between our history and someone else's, which is just, I think, not something the president should be involved in.
But I think it's something the president very much wants to be involved in, unfortunately. And we see this, you know, look, I think there is a worldview that is predicated on the idea that America sucks. And we see this among a lot of the college protests today, the institutional racism baked into the cake of the Constitution, that America was, you know, born a racist place. It has always been a rotten place. We never hear about the people who've made this country better, David.
No.
Right. We never hear about those folks who fought to make this a more perfect union. What we hear is that this wasn't perfect from the start, and therefore it has been a failed state ever since.
I mean, I wonder if Lucy Steigerwald or whoever else is arguing on the other side of this understands how racist a country like Japan was at the time and the things that they did to others. Now, that doesn't excuse what we do at all, but we have to compare and see where we stand in the world, and we have sins on our hands, no doubt. But in the 20th century, people were still acting that way, worse than we've ever acted. And we don't go around demanding apologies, but neither should we pretend that we're not. Listen, I don't want John Kerry to go over there and bang the table and demand an apology for, you know, how POWs were treated or something. But I also don't want him to go there and act like we are culpable for what happened, just as they were, when we did not attack them first, and we wanted to end that war long before it ended.
Just wait till we apologize for our destroyer getting in the way of those Russian fighter jets, David, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot to apologize for. I mean, if we're going down this road, we're going to have a lot to apologize for.
Yes, we are, and we'll all be on bended knee before long. David, listen, thank you so much for coming on the program. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
David Arsani, you join us writing again at the Federalist The Obama administration is now apologizing for America winning World War II. Fascinated, by the way, that this was brought up at the White House press briefing, and the response was not, this is silly. The response was, well, whatever the president decides to do. Because the president himself is heading over to Japan. Coming up, was it next month, I think, he's going to be in Japan for the G7. And so John Kerry, you know, he visited Hiroshima. He visited the memorial. Maybe paving the way for the president to pay a visit of his own next month. In fact, I would not bet against the president doing exactly that when he's in Japan. I based on what we've seen from the president's foreign adventures this year, seems like that would fit right in. All right, when we come back after a quick timeout, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins at Breitbart News says that gun grabbers are ubiquitous in the current 21st century Democratic Party. And he says you can find one or two gun grabbers in the Republican Party as well. Dr. Hawkins has provided a listicle of sorts. The four most infamous gun grabbers who are currently serving in elected office. The competition, unfortunately, is fierce, but he has narrowed it down to the final four, and we'll talk with Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins about it right after a quick timeout here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company.
Speaking with Jeff Gorman, he's an MP in Australia and also chairman of the Shooters and Fishers Party Victoria. Welcome, sir, to NRA News.
Thank you.
And welcome to the States.
Thank you. I've been enjoying my nearly 3 weeks now. It's an awesome country. I've only managed to fire a gun once. Whilst I've been here in the 3 weeks, it's been more or less work.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, you got to have a little time to shoot. So tell us, Jim, it's great we saw you here and we grabbed you, because let's talk about what's happening down in Australia. What's the latest on the fight for gun owners' rights down there?
Well, as you're aware, the current administration here has been using Australia as a poster child.
I noticed that, yes. Yeah.
So I'm here telling people that all is not what it seems. It's a case of, we have all these restrictions in Australia, and their public safety value is actually dubious at the best.
Okay, give us a for instance.
Well, we have classifications of rifles. In 1996, we had a massacre in Tasmania,
right.
And as a result of that, there was what was called the National Firearms Agreement was forced upon the states. Now, that classifies firearms into different sorts of firearms. A and B category are the normal sort of bolt actions and pump action rifles,
right.
And the usual sort of stuff. C category is for .22 semi-automatics and some centerfire rifles, and D category is for all the evil black rifles and so on.
They're so evil.
Now, with the B category, which is the general sort of centerfire thing, you can get pump action rifles, which is fine. But if the pump action rifle looks like an AR-15, for instance, it gets reclassified to the D category, which is all but impossible for a normal person to have. So it looks apparently kill.
Well, Jeff, the devil's in the details, and the bureaucrats really run the world, because they, with the paperwork and the machinations,
well,
they can make what seemingly innocuous regulations, Jeff, be very much not so.
Yeah, and that's the point I'm trying to bring. First of all, I mean, for our politicians, is, if there's no actual public safety outcome to it, why are we doing it? I mean, I've been a policeman in Australia before, in Victoria. I understand the need for, in our country, some rules that may or may not apply here. I'm not here to tell you how to run your country. But reclassifying a firearm based on its looks, because apparently that's bad. I mean, there is no actual reason for that except an ideological push to get rid of firearms.
Speaking with Jeff Borman, he's an MP down in Australia. He's also chairman of the Shooters and Fishers Party of Victoria. All right, Jeff, so let's recap so far, because I have more I want to talk to you about.
Sure.
All the stuff that the current administration is going around touting about how great everything is in Australia with gun laws, not exactly true.
No. Well, let's also, another thing they talk about, the theft of firearms from legitimate owners feeding the black market.
Right.
They've also coined a term called the grey market, which is for firearms that weren't handed back in 1996.
Okay.
But that's just a cynical way of trying to tie the law-abiding people into the criminals, because what they're saying is these people just didn't hand in these guns. So they're either black or white, as far as I'm concerned. It's either legal or illegal. There is no grey market.
Right. A legal gun is an illegal gun.
Yeah.
Right.
So, look, and effectively, the trying to use us as a poster child for gun control is just... It's unbelievable. The mainstream media, of course, don't want to have a bar of us. They don't want to have that discussion.
No.
Because we bring a narrative that completely opposes what they say.
It's easier for them just not to talk to you.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. I mean, I've got to say, I haven't had the mainstream media beating down my door to put me on some of these shows where they talk about gun control. But maybe my invitation got lost in the mail.
Yeah, perhaps. Spam email or something like that.
Well, you just can't tell.
Yeah. So what's your reaction? You've been up here in the States in a few weeks. What's been your reaction from folks up here to what you have to say?
It's been fantastic. I'm finding a lot of people, so they'll say to me, oh, look, they'll get my guns over my cold, dead hands and the Second Amendment and so on. But I also point out, people that come to these shows and the Dallas Safari Club convention where I was, they're law-abiding people, they're good people, they put into society. I ask them, do you really want to shoot a policeman that comes to your door to get your guns, or do you want to get shot by them and all this sort of thing? And I think the message I bring from that is, don't rely on the Second Amendment as such. You need to get yourself registered to vote, and you need to punish the people that are trying to take your guns away from you when you've done nothing wrong in the ballot box. And that way you avoid the whole problem.
Almost out of time. Just want to thank you, sir, for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by NASA. Oh, Cam, we got to ban this song. Too much patriarchy. Here comes your general gender-neutral person who you may or may not have wanted to see, I believe, is the... new version of this Pixies classic. Richard Grinnell with the Coalition for More Civil Liberties is going to join us next hour, talking about the Twitter censorship of an ad campaign by the Coalition for More Civil Liberties. This has been reversed. I'm glad to report that, at least. But it is another troubling sign. And again, this is a fact here. Being outrageously outraged about it doesn't really do anything. Twitter is a company that sets its own policies, as vague and as hard to understand as they might be. They can do this, but we have seen, it seems, more and more instances of particularly people on the right who say that they are being shadow banned, they are being outright banned from Twitter, or their viewpoints are otherwise being minimized there on the platform. So we'll talk with Richard Grinnell next hour. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from Breitbart News, our friend Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins is with us. How you doing, sir?
Doing great. Great to be with you.
Good to be with you as well. All right, so you've got a piece. I don't know how you narrow this down to four, be honest with you. You talk about the ubiquitous nature of gun grabbers in the current 21st century Democratic Party. You can find them in the Republican Party as well. But somehow, Dr. Hawkins, you managed to winnow the list down to the four worst gun grabbers currently serving in office, right? That's the criteria. They have to currently be an elected official right now.
Right. Currently, that's right. And I'll be honest with you, Cam, I thought about it for a while. But, yeah, you've got Dianne Feinstein. Her whole career is marked by gun bans. As you know, after the 1994 assault ban was signed, the very next year, she said that she regretted that it didn't include a confiscation clause. She didn't use those words. The word she used was that if she could have taken them all, she would have. So that marks her career throughout. After Sandy Hook, she pushed an assault weapons ban that would have also banned shotguns and many pistols that are very popular. My next guy was Manchin. Of course, Manchin was the architect of all those gun bans the architect of the gun control following Sandy Hook, which went down in flames on April 17th, 2013. But he continues to push it. He's unrepentant, and he fought an expansion of concealed carry in West Virginia. And then in addition to him, we have Schumer and we have Chris Murphy. And you know Chris Murphy. In a way, to me, Chris Murphy is the worst, in a way, and that's Senator Chris Murphy. And that's because he denies that the right to keep and bear arms is a God-given right. And once you deny that, then you're open to every form of gun control imaginable.
The actual quote here, the Second Amendment is not an absolute right, not a God-given right. It has always had conditions upon it like the First Amendment has.
you know, here's the thing. I mean, you can look at the language of the Second Amendment here. Let's see. Right of the people shall not be infringed. That would be the key words there, right? Talking about the limitations that could be right. imposed. But you know, here's the other problem, I think, with that statement by Senator Murphy. Can you imagine, Dr. Hawkins, a politician running saying, listen, I believe in the First Amendment, but we just need some common sense speech controls here.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
You know, if you are an elected official, it used to be anyway, that in both parties, you were talking about, I'm going to help you exercise your rights. I'm going to make sure that if you elect me, I'm going to be the person who is going to help you live the fullest, richest life that you can live as an American, rich in experience,
right.
rich in opportunity. Now it seems that message is, hey, you know what? I don't even think it's a real right. And so
right.
we're going to try to confine it and narrow it and restrict it as far as we can until we get that court decision that says, oh, you know what? Heller got it wrong. It's not a right after all. In which case, we'll go after the right entirely.
Right. No, you're exactly right. That is the position of the Democrat Party. And that's why my top four are all Democrat senators. But, you know, you asked, how do you narrow it to four? Well, we added honorable mention. Honorable mention goes to President Obama, who has sold an unbelievable amount of guns during the 7.5 years in office he's had to date. And honorable mention goes to Pat Toomey, who sided with Manchin in the gun control push in 2013, and as I wrote 2 or 3 weeks ago, who is running pro-gun control ads as part of his reelection effort in Pennsylvania even now. And then we go with Representative Mike Thompson, who is pushing for background checks with Gabby Giffords. And the hypocrisy of this always gets me. There's no editorializing here. This is just a statement of facts. He is pushing for every would-be gun owner to pass the same background check Gabby Giffords' attacker passed. If thinking about that doesn't show you the impotency of background checks, then nothing will. Pushing those as a solution, it's not really a solution. It's just another way to entrap law-abiding gun owners.
Talking again with Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart News about some of the most prolific anti-gun advocates that are currently serving. And as you mentioned, some of these folks up for re-election. Others are safely in their seats for another couple of years. But, you know, look, you look at the landscape right now politically. We were just talking about this a couple minutes ago. You've got Every Town for Gun Safety. Not only are they trying to convince as many candidates as possible around the country, run on gun control. They're also pushing these ballot initiatives. You've got what looks like Maine is going to have a ballot initiative. Nevada is going to have a ballot initiative. They're pushing for another one in Washington State. Could see a huge anti-gun referendum on the ballot in California. This is the year, Dr. Hawkins, that that they have decided they will push gun control. Now, I think it remains to be seen as to how excited the American public really is about this. You know, Hillary Clinton has been proclaiming herself to be the anti-gun candidate over on the Democratic side, and she's lost 8 straight Democratic primaries, which
right.
tells me that there's, you know, even if there is the expectation among the party establishment that, listen, if you're going to be a Democrat these days, you have to be anti-gun. You know this as well as I do. Virtually every public opinion poll that comes out there shows about 1/3 of Democrats are not anti-gun. They actually
right.
are pro-gun. They are either gun owners, they support the right to keep and bear arms, and they are being told by their party right now, frankly, that they don't matter. They can go pound sand.
Right. Well, if you look at the poll, I wrote on the Rasmussen poll yesterday, Kim, mm-hmm. and anybody who wants to Google search it can Google search my name or Breitbart in that poll. Here's what I found. Buried in that poll, I'm not saying Rasmussen did that on purpose by any stretch. I just mean at the bottom of the poll, 23% of Americans, or excuse me, about a quarter of Americans said they had bought a gun in the last year. 21%, which is almost a quarter, 21% of Democrats isolated said the same thing. So it goes to your point where you're talking about Democrats, the hierarchy is pushing a message that Democrats rank and file aren't really buying. Democrats rank and file are buying guns just like you and I are. So it's going to be interesting to see if they will swallow the message of Newsom out in California or of Bloomberg in Nevada. And I hope they don't swallow the message. I hope they reject it.
Well, we shall see. And all we can do is keep giving folks information. Dr. Hawkins, listen, thank you so much, sir, for coming on the program. It is always a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, thank you, Kim. God bless you, buddy.
You too. We'll talk again soon. Dr. Ada Bear Hawkins of Breitbart News joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Over on MSNBC Morning Joe, talking a little Hillary Clinton earlier this week. Again, this is part of her standard stump speech now, I think, in New York, is bringing up her support for gun control. And she had tweeted this out earlier in the week. I didn't realize that she had said this as well. Here's the quote. When challenged on his gun stances, Hillary Clinton said, he, meaning Bernie Sanders, frequently says, well, you know, I represent Vermont. It's a small rural state. We have no gun laws. Here's what I want you to know, she says. Most of the guns that are used in crimes and violence and killings in New York come from out of state. And the state that has the highest per capita number of those guns that end up committing crimes in New York come from Vermont. Now, Joe Scarborough said, after watching that, he said, I think Hillary is, you take the answers, those two clips right there, I think that's Hillary Clinton at her best. If that is Hillary Clinton at her best, doesn't that demonstrate how bad Hillary Clinton is? Because, again, the guns that end up committing crimes in New York. How many guns were arrested, Cameron, in New York last year? Do you know? For violent crimes. How many guns were charged in an armed robbery?
I couldn't even begin to guess.
Have to be thousands, right? Yeah, I mean just, yeah. Rikers Island is just full of guns locked up.
Absolutely.
And again, this is not a verbal tick. This is not misspeaking. This is not getting Colonel Klink and Sergeant Schultz confused, as I did earlier today. This is the intentional language. Because Hillary Clinton doesn't want to talk about the individuals who are committing violent crimes. She doesn't. I think she's terrified to talk about the individuals who are committing violent crimes. She'll talk about gun owners. She'll talk about the gun lobby. She'll talk about gun manufacturers. She'll talk about Vermont and the people who live there. And she'll talk about guns. But she won't talk about criminals. Which is why Hillary Clinton's proposals won't make anything better for the good people in bad neighborhoods. Because she can't diagnose the real issue. She thinks the issue is, well, if we just had tougher gun laws. If we all had laws like Chicago. If our national gun laws looked like Washington, D.C., well, then everything would be better. If our national gun laws looked like Washington, D.C., why would we think that our violent crime rate would look anything other than like Washington, D.C.'s or Chicago's? You know, again, we hear people like Hillary Clinton talk all the time about countries that implemented restrictive gun control laws. Why can't we just do what Australia did? Well, we're not Australia. Why even bring up Australia as the example? Why don't you talk about, I don't know, what Venezuela did? They're closer than Australia. They implemented restrictive gun control laws a few years ago. They banned the civilian possession of firearms. They would not issue any new firearms licenses in Venezuela. What happened? They've stopped keeping track of homicides in Venezuela. They're not reporting anymore the number of homicides in Venezuela. That's how high the homicide rate has become. Why don't we be like Mexico? Have you heard Hillary Clinton say, you know what, in Mexico, you can go get a gun at the one gun store in the country. It's on a military base in Mexico City. So my proposal is, let's take a page out of Mexico's playbook. I want one gun store. It could be a big one. You can put it in the middle of the country. It could be in Nebraska somewhere. And if you want a gun, you can go get that gun at the gun store in Nebraska. No, you haven't heard Hillary Clinton talk about it. Why? Because Mexico's violent crime rate is abysmal. And it's getting worse. It's a near failed state where pretty much everybody has guns except for the law abiding citizens who on paper anyway possess the right to own one. The cartels have them. Government has them. The police have them. The corrupt police have them. The corrupt government officials have them. Again, everybody seems to have a firearm in Mexico except for the law-abiding citizens who are told if you want one, go to Mexico City. Make an appointment at the military base. You know, again, we don't get an honest discussion. We get these tired and poll-tested sound bites. But we don't get a real honest conversation from Hillary Clinton about violent crime. All right, speaking of honest stories about violent crime, we've got our deal of the day coming up on the program next hour. Hero of the day as well. Also our good guy of the day, Richard Grinnell, as I mentioned, with the Coalition for More Civil Liberties, is going to be with us on the show. Kurt Schlichter out in California is going to join us as well next hour. This was the other thing I wanted to mention about Hillary Clinton, though, before we run out of time, because this was the one. Okay, so guns that end up committing crimes, and guns don't end up committing crimes. But the other little soundbite, most of the guns that are used in crimes and violence and killings in New York come from out of state. And the state that has the highest per capita number of those guns that end up committing crimes in New York come from Vermont. No, actually, again, the number one source state for firearms recovered in New York is New York State. That's it. The number one state supplying guns that were traced to New York is New York. And again, that is not uncommon. That's how it is for most of the country. The number one source state for firearms recovered will be that state. All right. We've got to take a timeout. When we return, Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company. We'll begin with the Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcore Defense. Deal of the Day, Good Guy and more. It's all coming up, so stick around. We will be right back here with more of your first source for Second Amendment news and information, NRA News, Cam and Company.
Speaking with Jonathan Rockett with the Shooting Club. Jonathan, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Great. I'm fantastic. Good to be here.
Well, you got a cool product. We were talking a little bit the other day, and I had to grab you guys over to talk about it. Tell me what is, and tell everyone else, what is the Shooting Club?
The Shooting Club is the world's first smartphone app that connects shooters across the country in competition for cash and prizes while promoting gun safety. We found that accidents happen with guns because people aren't proficient with them. They sit in a drawer. They don't know how to use them. Maybe you've been to a shooting range once or twice, but if you're rusty, it doesn't really matter. So we found that if we can find a way to reward people and make it fun and give away money, then people will take it a little bit more seriously. So we have a proprietary handicapping system which allows shooters who are very new beginners all the way up to retired cops and military to compete against one another on a fair playing field.
Dude, what a great concept. So, all right, so I got a lot of questions for you here. How before we go to how does it work, how did it go from this, hey, I got this great idea, to something that you're just getting ready to launch now in the App Store?
The whole idea started two Thanksgivings ago. My dad and I were talking. I was visiting him out in Houston, Texas, and he had commented he just got a new handgun, and his brother, who lives in Louisiana, had gotten one also. And they were trash-talking a little bit about who's a better shot. Mm. And he said, wouldn't it be cool if there was a website where we could upload pictures of our targets and see who was a better shot? My regular business and my background is in web development and design, and I said, you know what, that's a really good idea. We looked and we looked, and there was nothing like that out there, so we decided to build it ourselves. Two years later, here we are.
Wow, that is so cool. All right, so it's called the Shooting Club. How does it work?
So you download the free app from the iPhone store or from the Google Play store.
Got it.
And you find a local range using GPS on your phone if you've never been to a range. at the local range, you purchase one of our official competition targets. You scan the QR code, and then you take the target, which is very, very unique and fun, which is really the secret sauce of what we do. It's really four targets in one. You shoot it according to the rules. You use the app itself, which uses your native camera to take a picture, scores it, handicaps you, and uploads it into your activity feed so all your friends and followers and fellow gun lovers can see your scores.
That is so awesome. What a great idea.
You can even form private groups that are just for maybe a couple of buddies that are for your own private competitions as well.
And I'll tell you what, Jonathan, we're always talking about here in NRA News how important it is to keep the shooting sports and hunting and everything related to that, the Second Amendment, everything related, keep it vibrant, keep it growing, keep it relevant. And what a great way to do this, to actually be able to merge, because the biggest thing is people get so caught up in technology they actually don't go out and shoot anymore. But this merges technology with going out and shooting.
And it makes it social. We found that if you have a buddy that lives in another state and you both love to shoot, but you never have a chance to go together to a range and make it a social activity, now we've removed the geographic and the time borders to do
that.
As you follow people, you can post your stuff to Facebook, you can form your own private groups, upload pictures. Hey, I just got a brand new 9mm. I can't wait to try it out, etc. And what we found is this is bringing in some of the growing interest groups, such as women and millennials, who are newer to shooting sports, and it gives them a platform to really take it and run with it.
Before we run out of time, how do we get more information about the Shooting
Club? You can go to theshootingclub.com or look for the app, The Shooting Club, in your app store.
Jonathan Rocket, The Shooting Club, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRE News.
You bet. It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company. Starts right now. On the program this hour, we have the hero of the day presented by AdCorp Defense, our deal of the day. Good guy of the day as well. Also, Richard Grinnell with the Coalition for More Civil Liberties. And Kurt Schlichter, the author of Conservative Insurgency, will join us on the program. The fine folks over at Reason Magazine talking about a new poll of millennial women. Now, keep in mind here what we have seen among the anti-gun activists lately. We've seen the special section of Cosmopolitan magazine, right? Meet the Gunsplainers. Hello. Hi. I'm one of them. We saw Marie Claire magazine and their special section on why women should not own guns. This has been a big push here recently. But Reason points out in this poll of young women, ABC News and Refinery 29, asking young women a number of questions about their how they identify politically. By the way, 40% call themselves independent, 38% call themselves Democrat, 16% call themselves Republican, 6% no response. Party ties aside, Elizabeth Nolan Brown at Reason says 38% describe themselves as liberal, 30% describe themselves as moderate, 26% as conservative. Compared to older women, millennial ladies who identify as conservative are 12 points less likely to call themselves Republican, which is interesting. 31% named Sanders as their top choice. 25% named Hillary Clinton. The Republican candidates combined earned 21% of the potential vote, while 18% of those surveyed said that they had no preference. So you look politically, seem to be supporting Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton. This would appear to be an easy sell for Cosmo, for Everytown, for Marie Claire. And yet, when you look at the top issues for millennial women in this poll, 21% economic inequality. 21% student loan debt. You're hearing a lot of talk about those issues among the Democratic candidates, aren't you? 11% equal pay for women, 11% preserving access to abortion, We've also heard a lot of talk from the Democratic candidates about those issues. This week we just saw a day of discussion, a designated day of discussion on equal pay. Which, by the way, Cameron, that phrase really needs to enter the official lexicon, a designated day of discussion about topic X. Friday will be the DDD day, the DDD for, you know, GMO apples or whatever it might be. Designated day of discussion. Also, at 11% is an issue that you have not heard Democratic candidates talk about. Protecting gun rights. One of the top issues for millennial women. Not, by the way, eradicating gun rights. Protecting gun rights. This, again, they were asked which of seven issues they found most important. Most important. 21% economic inequality, 21% student loan debt, 11% protecting gun rights, 11% equal pay for women, 11% preserving access to abortion, 11% other, 8% lowering taxes, 4% strengthening the military. Huh. And again, where is that discussion among Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders other than, and again, the anti-gun groups, other than to say, don't own a gun. For goodness sakes, whatever you do, don't ever date a guy who owns a gun. And by the way, don't want to own a gun either. Not only don't ever actually own one, should never want one. And there are a number of millennial women for whom this is the most important issue. Again, that's how the question was asked. What issue among these do you find most important? Not is this an important issue for you? Which one is the most important issue for you? And among those millennial women who were surveyed again, right up there with equal pay, preserving access to abortion, protecting gun rights. But you won't hear in Brooklyn during the debate between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders any talk about actually protecting and preserving those rights. All right, let's get to our hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorps Defense. Today's story from WDAM, the story of a intruder who picked the wrong house in Jones County, Mississippi. Jones County Sheriff's Department said Timothy Jeffcoat of So-So, Mississippi, was trying to visit a woman at a home when police say he became belligerent and refused to leave. According to the news release, the victim, a man of the residence, said Jeffcoat then tried to force his way into the home. Man then shot Jeffcoat in the upper left chest. While Jeffcoat was receiving medical attention, deputies found over a gram of methamphetamine on his person. He was taken to a local hospital where he is expected to recover. And that homeowner there in Jones County, Mississippi, defending himself, today's hero of the day. Our deal of the day. Jim Garrity was with me here in studio as I was looking for our deal earlier today, and I just couldn't. I just saw the story and I just went, made it one of those noises. And he said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "It just amazes me that after 10 years or more of finding these stories, that I can still find these stories that just shock me, like this one." From ABC 5, a Cleveland man charged with the murder of his fiancée after claiming that she accidentally fell has a long criminal history of violence against women, according to court records. Clarence Bogan III, charged with charged with aggravated murder, felonious assault, and domestic violence late last week. Nearly 2 months after Bogan's 39-year-old fiancée, Stacey Marie Tucker, died of blunt force trauma injuries inside of Bogan's apartment. Channel 5 says the aggravated murder charge is the latest in a string of criminal charges and convictions tracing back to 1982. That's when Bogan was convicted of raping a 15-year-old. He was paroled in 1989. He did 7 years. He returned to prison after allegedly assaulting another woman. While in prison, Bogan was charged with several counts of gross sexual imposition. He was released in 2006, and he was again accused of raping a woman in June of 2007. Victim said that Bogan beat her, choked her, forced her to withdraw money from a bank. Bogan was later charged with kidnapping and raping two more women. And what happened in 2007, a year after this guy got out of prison for rape? He pleads guilty to 3 counts of rape, and he gets 7 years. 7 years. Jonathan Whitmer Rich is a associate law professor at Cleveland Marshall College of Law. He said, to my mind, 7 years seems pretty lenient for 3 rapes, but on the other hand, it was a guilty plea, so we don't know the circumstances of that plea. Uh-huh. On the other hand, it was a guilty plea. Channel 5 says Ohio is not one of the 26 states with a three-strike law that increases prison penalties for habitual offenders. He says, we can't know if a three-strike policy would have kept this man off the streets, but this is a bad criminal history. And it seems to suggest a variety of indications that he is dangerous to women. Yeah, perhaps the multiple rape convictions would suggest that. It was February the 10th, Bogan told neighbors that his girlfriend was drunk and, quote, fell 4 times, causing a fatal head injury. The next day, the 55-year-old Bogan published at least 2 fundraising pages asking for money for his girlfriend's funeral expenses, saying that she had died, quote, from a head injury suffered in an accidental fall in the early morning. The apartment manager there said that he and others suspected foul play because Bogan was speaking with many of the residents to, quote, make sure that they had their story straight. Bogan also had not registered as a sex offender, as he was required under law to do. Not only Clarence Bogan, but 3 other residents in that apartment complex were told to leave because they had not registered. J. Anthony Smith, the apartment manager, said, quote, it's starting to make me think this man should be kept off the streets. Starting to. Huh. Well, he's wanted for murder. He's been convicted of raping at least 4 other women. He's been convicted of, allegedly assaulted at least 1 other woman. And just starting to think maybe this guy needs to be off the streets. Huh. I would have thought that conclusion would have been reached years ago. But Clarence Bogan III is still on the street, at least as of right now. He is a wanted man. And he is today's deal of the day. Our good guy of the day. Get another one of those kind of quiet little stories. He's getting some good press locally. Temecula, California. The Valley News reporting. It was March 15th. Pamela Johnson says she was going into the Salvation Army, and she saw a motor officer parked out front. She said, I initially thought this was my husband, But after passing him to get to my parking spot, I soon realized that it was not. Pamela's husband also is a police officer. So she said that she saw a man walking towards this officer, Deputy Sean Gerganius. She said the man looked like he had seen better days. As the man approached, the guy, by the way, did not want to be identified, but he approached the deputy, Pamela Johnson, heard the deputy say, "All right, let's do this." She, her first thought was that this guy was in trouble, that the deputy was there to, I don't know, arrest him, do something. Okay, let's do this. What's this here? So Pamela Johnson said she watched the two guys walk together into the Salvation Army. And as they entered the business, Pamela Johnson overheard the deputy say to the man, "Let's get you some clothes." And then she said she watched as Sean Gerganius took his time, helped the guy pick out some clothing items, which Deputy Gerganius then paid for. Pamela Johnson saw this, and she says she was just so touched that she asked if she could take a couple of pictures of the two gentlemen, and they both agreed. She said, "I know this lovely and kind act isn't limited to Deputy Gerganius alone. There are countless men and women of the Riverside County Sheriff's Department who have generously given and haven't had the luck of having their pictures taken." She says still others would rather remain anonymous in their giving. She said she felt fortunate enough to be in the right place at the right time to be able to witness and pass on, quote, "the heartfelt deed that reflects the heart of Deputy Gerganius." And she said, "God bless the men and women behind the badge. Their hard work and humanity has made us all a safer and a better community." Again, this is not the type of story you're going to see, likely, on the local news. Because it's not like deputies like Sean Gerganius call up a newsroom and say, "Hey, I'm about to go buy a homeless guy some clothes. Do you want to come bring a camera crew out here?" They might say yes. Don't get me wrong. They might. Oh, that's a great kicker story. That's a great human interest story. But Deputy Gerganius isn't going to do that. It's a little self-serving. So a big tip of the cap to Deputy Sean Gerganius, but also a tip of the cap to Pamela Johnson, who I'm guessing as the wife of a police officer does understand that these officers are not likely to seek attention for themselves. It's not what it's about. But she recognized that being in the right place at the right time gave her an opportunity to do the right thing and to help spread the word about this simple act of kindness. So a tip of the cap to Pamela Johnson there as well. All right, when we return here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, we're going to keep our attention actually on California, maybe move up the state a little bit towards Silicon Valley. We'll talk with Richard Grinnell with the Coalition for More Civil Liberties. What's going on here with Twitter? A campaign launched by the Coalition for More Civil Liberties yanked from Twitter and then reinstated in a dizzying couple of hours. We'll try to get to the bottom of it with Richard Grinnell right after this quick timeout here on NRA News, Cam and Company.
Speaking with Eric Lipp with the NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program, tell us about the new website for kids that you guys have going on.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a brand new interactive website just for kids now. It goes along with our materials, our written materials that we've always had in the past. But if you go to eddieeagle.com, real simple, can't get any easier. You go to eddieeagle.com. There's you can obviously watch our video. There's some storybooks that kids can go along with. There's coloring pages. There's a sing-along, and a bunch of other good stuff. And we're going to keep growing that section. And it's just for kids. It works on iPads, your phone, everything that kids are on these days. And it's a great resource for parents.
So we have the Eddie Eagle. There's a component for the adults and people interested in programming. This is specifically for kids.
Correct. Yeah, we have eddieeagle.nra.org for parents. It's the same website we've always had. It has stuff for parents. You can download information on the program. You can download instructor information if you actually want more materials to actually teach to your kids. But we've just created the new site is eddieeagle.com. It's just for kids. It's formatted all for kids. Like I said, it works great on iPads. It's a real hit. We did a lot of Great American Outdoor Show with it, and it's got just a ton of interactive stuff for just kids.
Beautiful. It's always good to see Eddie keeping up with the times, Eric. And tell folks who don't know, what is the Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program?
The Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program is a very simple, easy program. It's all centered for children pre-K through fourth grade, that if they ever come across a firearm, they need to stop, don't touch, run away, tell a grown-up. Everything's centered simply about safety. We're not here out to push the NRA or be a political program. We're just strictly a safety program, and we've been around for quite a while. We're actually about to reach our 29 millionth child.
29 million kids. How can folks get more information about this?
They can obviously just go to the website, eddieeagle.com.
Eric Lipp, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Not a problem. Thanks for having us.
You know the threat is real. You sit in meetings with advisors and operatives who tell you there could be Islamic sleeper cells in every major American community. You know the southern border is a welcome mat for terrorists to enter our towns and neighborhoods at will. You know about their plots to kill us in our shopping malls, our sports stadiums, and our office buildings. You won your office by talking like a champion of freedom. Now it's time to act like one. Pass a national right to carry law that guarantees my constitutional right to defend myself, my family, and my fellow Americans anywhere inside our borders. And make sure the enemies of freedom know the power of freedom. No law-abiding American should be forced to face evil with empty hands. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
To the Ayatollahs of Iran and every terrorist you enable, listen up. You might have met our fresh-faced flower child president and his weak-kneed Ivy League friends. But you haven't met America. You haven't met the heartland, where the people will defend this nation with their bloody, calloused, bare hands. That's what it takes. You haven't met the steel workers and the hard rock miners or the swamp folks in Cajun country who can wrestle a full-grown gator out of the water. You haven't met the farmers, the cowboys, the loggers, and the truck drivers. You don't know the mountain men who live off the land or the brave cops who fight the good fight in the urban war zones. No, you've never met America. And you ought to pray you never do. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Kurt Schlichter will be joining us a little bit later on in the hour. I believe he actually is wearing his Peter Criss makeup this afternoon. It's Thursday, right? Yeah, it's Peter Criss Day for Kurt Schlichter. Right now, I want to welcome from the Coalition for More Civil Liberties, Mr. Richard Grinnell. Richard, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. So yesterday, I'm driving home, getting ready to drive home after the show, and I see your tweets talking about what's going on here. This campaign that the Coalition for More Civil Liberties had on Twitter had been yanked. The Daily Caller had a story. Honestly, Richard, I'm glad to see that this was hopefully resolved fairly quickly. But what actually happened? Let's talk about this ad campaign that was up on Twitter, and then what you heard when this campaign was pulled.
Yeah, so it was really actually quite shocking for us, because it was a simple ad on Twitter asking people to sign a petition that would stop Gavin Newsom's really civil liberties violation. He's proposing to have a background check registry on ammo in the state of California. So we have been organizing against it. We put up a simple ad on Twitter that just asked people to sign a petition to protect their civil liberties. It was that simple. The ad ran for around 2 weeks, roughly, and then all of a sudden it got pulled, and we got a notification from Twitter saying that the ad had been pulled for business practice reasons, which was really perplexing. And so we immediately kind of asked questions and called Twitter and said, you know, what's the reasoning? Why are you pulling this ad? It's a simple ad. It's a petition ad. It's been running. You've been taking our money for 2 weeks, and then suddenly, all of a sudden, it's against your business practices. So we just heard, you know, simply from the lower levels at Twitter that it was just a reasoning that they pulled it was unknown. And so we didn't want to sit there and just let that happen. So we asked to speak to a supervisor, and we were able to talk to somebody higher up at Twitter who said that a human looked at this. It wasn't an automated system that pulled it, but a human determined this to be against their business practices. So we took to Twitter ourselves, and we were sharing the ad on social media, and we were complaining loudly, and you know, we had a whole bunch of civil liberty advocates that immediately jumped in and tried to help us.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, within 24 hours, Twitter turned it around, and they decided to put the ad back up. We got an email from them saying, we apologize. It shouldn't have been pulled down, and we're putting your ad back up.
Wow. All right, now, given that this, as you say, Twitter told you that a human being actually looked at this and took it down, not that Twitter owes you an explanation, Richard, but did you hear anything about what might be happening as far as personnel goes? Is Bobby going to have a talking to, or whoever it was?
Other than we had a nice gentleman who reached out to us. We talked to him on the phone, and he said it should have never been pulled down. So my question to him is, you know, did it get put back up? And was it highlighted to higher ups at Twitter simply because we were loud and we complained? Because then my next concern is, what happens to those people who don't have a Twitter army,
mm-hmm.
who are having their civil liberties violated on a daily basis, who are, you know, maybe having their Twitter accounts deleted? And that's been happening. And I think Breitbart News has highlighted a couple of different individuals that have had that happen to them. So while we're pleased that the ad was put back up, we're also still very concerned that the only reason our ad was put back up is because we had a loud Twitter army who were complaining. And I want to make sure that you don't have to have a Twitter army in order to have freedom of expression and your Twitter account violated.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And you're right. We have seen this. You know, the term shadow banning, I don't think existed a year ago. But we certainly have. I've even had people who follow me on Twitter saying, I'm not seeing your stuff in my feed. So I don't know if this is a glitch. This is, you know, this is one of the problems, Richard. Right? Is this a bug? Is this a glitch? Or is this intentional? Is this, you know, a rewriting of the algorithm? So, you know, and we know that Twitter is constantly tweeting.
I don't buy that it's an algorithm or a glitch. There's just no way that happened, because when we pushed back initially, we were told that a human looked at it and determined that it was against the business practices. So what I actually think is happening is that there is a discussion within Twitter about how much, to let go, so to speak, when it comes to freedom of expression, because the place is filled with a bunch of liberals who want to have politically correct conversations. And so I sadly think that the only reason the ad got put back up is because we took it to the press. We were loud. The Twitter army responded. And the pressure that was built on Twitter for 24 hours bubbled up to the point where somebody inside said, it's not worth it. We got to put the ad back up.
Talking again with Richard Grinnell with the Coalition for More Civil Liberties. This highlights, as you say, Richard, a much broader, bigger issue than just this particular instance. And I'm not sure, I'm not sure how you fight this, because Twitter is a private company. They can set their policies, but what we're not seeing is transparency. What we're not seeing is a clear explanation of, look, here are our rules, here are our standards, even in this case. Well, you were told the nebulous phrase bad business practices, but you were never actually told what those might be.
Correct. And so I think you're exactly right. This is a private company. They get to do what they want. But But the pretenses for Twitter is that this is a public space where everyone is welcome. So if it's a private company that's going to have some sort of policy that is looking for and policing politically incorrect in their interpretation, politically incorrect content, then I think that it's a hypocrisy issue and that we're right to point it out. We need to be told what the policy is, and it needs to be very clear. If it's a Twitter policy that everyone is welcome, then everyone should be welcome.
Listen, I don't have a problem with that. I'd love to see that. And I it's been a while since Twitter started, but I seem to remember in the early days of the platform, Richard, I mean, that was one of the things that the company touted was the ability for people to find their voice where they couldn't have found it before.
Right. And it does work usually, but in the instances where like in our situation where the ad is taken down, there's a lot of explaining that has to be done because we were told that a human reviewed it and it clearly was down for 24 hours as the media pressure continued, as the Twitter army erupted, and it seems to me that the policy was changed after a lot of pressure.
All right, so if that's the case, then it would also seem to me, Richard, that one of the reasons why this was pulled is because there are people who are concerned about the impact, frankly, that the Coalition for More Civil Liberties is having. You all have, in a very short amount of time, built up a very broad coalition. Everybody from, you know, again, gun owners to prosecutors to sheriffs, a variety of Californians from all backgrounds and all walks of life. Who have said, listen, this is not the way to go here. And this message, it really does seem to be resonating in California, Richard.
It totally does. And I think that was the most frustrating part of this ad. It wasn't a gun ad. It didn't have a gun. It didn't say anything about, you know, more guns or more ammunition. It simply said, sign this petition if you're concerned about your civil liberties. And so we have in California done something that I think is pretty remarkable in that the coalition against Gavin Newsom's ballot initiative to try to make ammunition something that you have to register. There's just been an across-the-board, you know, straight, gays, Asians, Hispanics, gun owners, non-gun owners, who simply have stood up to say, enough is enough. You're taking away too many civil liberties, and we're not going to take it. So the broad coalition that we've put together is striking for, I think, a lot of the liberals in California to see. They have been put on notice that they've crossed the line, and the people are rising up. And so I think that's what happened. You know, the one thing that I have to say, maybe it's separate, maybe it's coincidence, but Gavin Newsom has received more than $100,000 from two different individuals who are executives at Twitter. So the Twitter family, the Twitter employees, executives who make decisions are very close to Gavin Newsom, and they want him to succeed. They actually got some tax breaks to move into a building, and Gavin Newsom also was able to get about $10,000 in credits to move into that same building. And so the link there is troubling, I think, on a lot of levels. And to see Twitter become so active to help Gavin Newsom, you know, everybody in California knows that this ballot initiative is really the beginning of Gavin's campaign to run for governor. So he's rallying this ballot initiative, scaring people about guns, and really what he's doing is it's a year early than his political campaign for governor starts, and so he's trying to build an operation, get fundraisers, and you know, garner all the media attention early on.
You know, and what you talk about, I mean, so there was that book that came out, I think it was a couple of years ago, about Washington, D.C., Richard, called This Town, right? And the relationship between the press and politicians and how that's a, you know, at the end of the day, it is a small town in that regard. it almost seems like there needs to be a Silicon Valley version of this town being written, because Silicon Valley is, again, where you find that nexus of media and politics. Only Washington, D.C., you've got a lot of media covering Washington, D.C. You have a lot of media that covers the tech aspects of Silicon Valley, but I'm not sure that we have a lot of reporting on the political aspects of Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I mean, really what you're asking for is real journalism, whether it's in Washington, D.C. or Silicon Valley, Hollywood or Wall Street. We need journalists. We need people to stop just retweeting and retweeting on social media. Get off social media and start researching. I see it every day with reporters who are so lazy and they sit around on social media. Gone is the day where they dig and they find sources rather than try to find, people who really know what's going on and have on the record sources. They're willing to just repeat and retweet a bunch of content that they have no idea is accurate or not. And I think what we all are calling for is more journalism.
I would be absolutely fine with that. Again, as long as it's actual journalism, not more listicles and cat memes and
exactly.
and cheap gossip. And again, favoring one point of view over another. Richard, listen, thank you so much for coming on the program. If people do want to be involved with the Coalition for More Civil Liberties, how do they do so?
It's very easy. Just go to stopgavinnewsom.org. That's stopgavinnewsom.org.
All right, Richard, thanks again for your time, sir. Hope we can do this again soon.
All right, thank you.
You bet. Richard Grinnell joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Mr. Kurt Schlichter, author of Conservative Insurgency, high-powered L.A. attorney as well, is going to join us on the program. I've got some legal questions for Kurt Schlichter that we'll get into right after this quick timeout. Stick around. There is more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking to our good friend John Anoni with 2 Million Bullets and Camp Compass. John, welcome back to NRA News. How are you, my friend?
I am on top of the world.
How's Allentown?
Allentown is in need of some improvement, and I guess that's why I'm there.
Amen, brother. So first, before we get in, you got some neat projects I want to talk to you about. Yeah. But tell folks, what is 2 Million Bullets and what's Camp Compass? What do you do?
2 Million Bullets is actually an orange-ribbon campaign to prioritize our children in the youth shooting sports. That as well as Camp Compass, which is a nonprofit that rewards inner-city kids with outdoor excursions, basically hunting and shooting.
How long have you been doing this?
Ooh, I've been grinding a long time, 20 years. 20 years, 22 at the camp. I've been in the classroom for another 27. So we tend to say that there is nobody walking this earth that knows kids better than I.
Yeah, I would say that's true. So let's step back for a second before we talk about your new project. How did you get into all this?
You know, it wasn't by my choice, actually. Sometimes this road that I'm on is a pretty lonely road, because saving kids is not an easy thing, especially, you might as well put devil horns on me, because not only do I save them through using the gun, but I save them through killing stuff.
Wow.
Basically our critters, so it's
God's
something
little
where,
creatures, yeah, John. What kind of person are you?
You know, according to my kids, a pretty darn good one, it's something where, I found this because of a need. And wanted to make sure that other kids who had the same need, have that fulfilled.
Awesome. So what did that lead to first? What's the timeline?
Camp Compass, I actually started out of the back of my truck in 94. Just thought the books weren't cutting it and needed to reflect on my life to see what made a difference in my life. And, of course, it was shooting. And it was hunting non-traditionally, of course. With that, went back into the classroom to teach, to try to help, and just figured out that it was something that I needed to give back.
Well, I'll tell you what, John, I've been talking to a lot of people about this. What you're doing now and been doing for 20 years couldn't be more important now, because there's a lot of talk about not only about hunter numbers, and some people say they're going up, they're going down, but it's not just that. It's just attack on that lifestyle, on hunting, on the outdoor sports, on shooting, like from people on the other side who have really ramped up the rhetoric. Your devil horns, yeah, John, are growing bigger and bigger and bigger because they think you're so evil.
You're right. And you know what? If I could kind of counter that a little bit, what's starting to be a pretty neat role that's starting to happen is people on the other side are starting to come to me and say, you know what? I'm looking at this a little differently because you're saving our kids. And you know, it's something where it's hard to be the king of both mountains. But I can tell you that there are some people on the other mountain that are starting to climb up mine because they understand that our kids, their lives are critical. And they want to see ultimately kids win just like we do. And
absolutely.
I think we're starting to convince some people that what we do is a pretty good thing.
Awesome. All right, so let's talk about the new camp. What do you have going on? Something new.
You know what? Actually, we have a new documentary that is coming out called Camouflaging Our Differences. Pretty strong title. And mm-hmm. And I say that with excitement because I think we get a knock in the industry in regards to who the industry is, you know, who the industry is portrayed to be. And I can tell you, I walk the halls and I meet with people constantly that are of color and of non-color. And I can tell you what, the bottom line for us is kids. So that's the reason we decided to name it Camouflaging Our Differences. It may shake some people up a little bit because they might be a little uncomfortable. However, change is coming.
Sometimes, John, people need to be shaken up a little bit.
Well, and I don't do it, you know, because I get a rise out of it. I do it.
No,
because
I mean with respect.
No, yeah. Understood. Yeah. I do it because you know it's necessary for me to save kids' lives. And you know, I could walk 30 kids through this hall today, and they would receive the same love that I would get, probably even more, because once again, our people want to see these kids win, not necessarily in a pro-gun agenda, but in life.
Right. All right, John Annone, 2 Million Bullets and Camp Compass. How do we get more information about all the great things that you're doing?
You know what? You can look me up on those sites, 2 Million Bullets, 2millionbullets.com.org, or campcompass.com or .org, and you'll find me there.
John Annone, thank you so much for what you have done and what you continue to do. And thanks for visiting us here at NRA News.
Ah, pleasure.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Our friend Kurt Schlichter joins us on the program right now from out in California. How you doing, sir?
Oh, doing great. How about you?
I am excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. Are you going to be tuning in to the Battle of Brooklyn tonight? Bernie and Hillary squaring off in the...
Absolutely not. It's like the world's least hot cat fight.
You just no interest, huh?
Zero. It's less than no interest. I am actually disinterested in other things peripherally and collaterally because of this.
All right. Well, I guess I won't ask any questions about that. Actually, I am going to ask you some legal questions here, because one of the things, I don't know, again, you not having any interest in this, you might not be aware, but I bet you probably are. Bernie Sanders has been hit hard by Hillary Clinton this week for Vermont's gun laws. Kurt, Hillary Clinton says that you've got guns from Vermont that are committing crimes in New York. Guns from Vermont. They're,
yes,
they're
migrating down to New York. So basically what she said is this is what she's saying. People in New York are natural criminals who go to a safe state where people behave like civilized people, according to Hillary Clinton, and bring guns with them, when the guns, of course, don't go out on their own, because as we know, weapons migrate.
Right.
So she's basically saying, look, because New Yorkers are incapable of functioning as civilized, intelligent citizens, Vermonters should not be able to either. That's what I get. That's kind of like a New York values thing, as I see it.
I think there is a little bit of that there. Now, one of the other things that she's also been hitting Bernie on is the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. Now, she's going after Bernie Sanders because he voted for this bill, but she's really been going after the gun manufacturers, the gun lobby, the NRA, gun owners. She does not like this law. She apparently believes, Kurt, that you should be able to hold gun manufacturers responsible for the actions of criminals.
Well, of course she does. And it's funny. I defend companies and individuals who people sue because third parties commit crimes. And it's, you know, not part of the law. You know, it's not a thing because they have this problem called the Constitution, and they have this problem called the legislatures, which won't enact the law she wants. So she wants to create a new legal doctrine holding people who are under no other laws responsible for the crimes of third parties. And the idea is not that they're actually responsible. The idea is, of course, to bankrupt them.
Right. Well, this okay, so I was going to ask, under this legal theory that Hillary Clinton has promoted here, how would it be any different, Kurt, to say, look, we've got opioid overdoses that are at an all-time high, and we've got doctors that are prescribing a lot of these pills. We've got pharmaceutical companies that are making these pills knowing full well that a certain portion of those pills are going to be used illegally, and people are going to die. Therefore, we need to sue the pharmaceutical companies for manufacturing this product that people are misusing at a record rate and overdosing on. What would be any different?
Well, actually, the case against an opioid manufacturer would be a much stronger one for a number of reasons. First of all, opioids aren't specifically provided for in the Constitution as something every American has a right to have. The second thing is when you're taking an opioid, you're taking it yourself. And this is an effect, and the effect it has on you is part and part of lawful use. In other words, you can become addicted to an opioid through lawful use. You can't commit you can't hurt someone with a gun through lawful use.
Mm-hmm.
So it's and still I would think that the case against the opioid manufacturer would be a bad one for other reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But look, it's terrible on the law. She's not even faking it. This isn't law, okay? This is what liberals in every realm seem to be doing, which is abandoning basic principles of law in favor of short-term political gain, whether it's ignoring the manifest violations of 18 United States Code, that the classified material handling laws that Hillary's done, just ignoring them, or ignoring the violations of law of the IRS, or a myriad other illegal aliens, just simply ignoring that. They simply have abandoned the whole concept of the rule of law. This is incredibly dangerous.
It absolutely is. Again, we see this. It's not just with this one issue. You know, if Hillary Clinton, again, were being...
No, it is a theme.
Yes. If Hillary Clinton were being consistent here, she would be demanding that Goldman Sachs and Wall Street be held responsible for their role in the mortgage meltdown. But we haven't really seen Hillary Clinton do that. Maybe she called on those things to happen when she was getting her couple hundred thousand dollar speeches.
That happened. It's in the transcript. She doesn't want that released. Yeah, it's... The lack of respect for law and basic principles, and they think they can just skip this stuff over and that it's not going to change society. And when it changes society, because it will, and we've already seen it to some extent with the Donald Trump phenomenon and the Bernie Sanders phenomenon, I don't think they're going to like how it turns out. But, you know, I did see a statistic that makes me very, very happy today.
What's that?
The statistic, and I did a little division because I'm a math guy. Apparently last year there were 63,000 firearms background checks every single day.
That sounds about right. I'm not going to check your math right here, but that sounds accurate. And, you know, Kurt, I mean, month after month we keep seeing records set as far as NICS checks performed. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, we've got the NRA annual meeting coming up in Louisville next month. I think that there are going to be tens of thousands of people there. I haven't seen that grassroots anti-gun campaign. I'll be honest with you. In fact, Reason Magazine had a survey today. There's a CBS News survey of millennial women. And among the most important issues for millennial women, Kurt, protecting gun rights.
Excellent. Finally, something I can get behind the millennials on. We may disagree about vinyl, about allegedly delicious craft beer, which I think is overrated, but at least they're embracing the Second Amendment. That's a start. We found some common ground.
They are. And this is not the first poll to find this, by the way. You can go
back several years ago. There have been polls out of Wisconsin that showed millennials were very supportive of concealed carry when that law was new there in the state of Wisconsin. You know, a number of Pew and Gallup surveys have shown that millennial support for the right to keep their arms is high. This is one of the reasons why every town and the anti-gun groups are turning to places like Cosmopolitan to try to convince women you don't want to own a gun and you don't want to date a gun owner because that's bad. You don't want to do that.
Want to date a gun owner. They want to ride the wind. You know, ride the whirlwind. Hey, you know, look, I'm missing something here. Now, we're at, what, 7 or 8 states that are now constitutional carry?
Let's see. Alaska, Vermont, Arizona, West Virginia.
West Virginia
Idaho
just did it.
Idaho just did it as well.
Oklahoma's talking about it.
Yep.
Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the bloodbath?
Oh,
I was in Arizona last week.
Yeah.
I spent 3 days there doing depositions. You know what I didn't see? Any violence.
Well, that's because you were huddled in your hotel room, right?
I was huddled in my hotel room a bit. But true, but even in my time out interacting with people, I felt no sense of fear among people. No tense. I was in the Army. I've been in places where it gets tense. It was generally a happy place. Where's the bloodbath? Where is the bloodbath now that people simply may decide for themselves whether they're going to exercise their constitutional rights or not?
It's not there in Arizona. The law, went into effect in 2010. The homicide rate has declined every year since. The violent crime rate has declined, with one exception, which it ticked up just a blip. Robberies are down. Forcible rapes are down. Aggravated assaults are down. And by the way, you know, the concealed carry license didn't go away in Arizona. You're not required to have one if you're an Arizona resident to carry in Arizona. But the number of concealed carry licenses has actually gone up in the state of Arizona since constitutional carry was passed, Kurt. You're right. These predictions, and they're the same predictions that you could go back to the late 80s when Florida was first implementing concealed carry. Same tired arguments. It's going to be the Wild West. There's going to be blood in the streets. There's going to be, shootouts in parking lots. And that none of it ever happens in any of these states that have adopted concealed carry or constitutional carry. Nowhere does that happen.
Well, where it's happened? It's in gun-free New York City, up 4.5%.
Yeah, and in Chicago, Illinois, where it's up, an abysmal amount. And to that end, when you look at the reality, the actual facts on the ground as opposed to the rhetoric. How do you – because here's one of the problems. There was a report, I think it was out last week, showing, violent crime at 40-year lows, but most Americans think that violent crime is skyrocketing. And I think a lot of that goes to the media. So,
well, you and I remember when crime was really bad, which is the early 90s.
Yes.
I thought it was ironic that last week Bill Clinton stepped in to defend his when the Democrat Party finally took the side of citizens against criminals, and that was what really rocketed Bill Clinton to popularity and to success. That was holding Democrats back, and now they're going the other way. And I think I think we're going to see in big cities at least where those kind of people, liberals, are in charge, we're going to see more crime. And in places where we trust citizens to protect themselves and understand that the cause of crime is criminals, I think we're going to continue to see crime rates declining. And they're going to look for something to blame, and it's going to be guns, because apparently people in liberal cities are incapable of behaving like civilized human beings, according to them.
Yeah. Talking again with Kurt Schlichter. All right, listen, we've only got a couple minutes left. I've got to ask you about this event that I saw you publicizing on your Twitter feed at the UCB Theater? Is this right?
Yes, I was on a panel called Electoral Dysfunction. There was a political panel, bunch of Los Angeles liberal comedians, comics, and me, and followed up by some, more comedy after. Very interesting. Being the only conservative, I said, "Hey, I'm diversity. I'm a, You know, I'm a conservative veteran who believes in God. And they thought that was interesting. One of the guys goes, well, does anyone else here believe in God? Well, Arena. So there's like 80 people or 50, 80 people in the place. And me and Arena are the only ones who play in God. So this kind of tells you the demographic bubble that we're in. Not exactly representative of Farmville, would you say? I mean, it was just funny. I said, well, I kept referring it to being in, you know, this West L.A. bubble. And we're in Hollywood, right? And somebody goes, we're not in West L.A. That's over there to the west. I'm like, have you just written off all of East Los Angeles? Because that's where the minority people are. Oh, they didn't like that.
Oh, I imagine.
I didn't like that. No. Nope.
Oh, my
didn't
goodness.
Like that. Didn't like that.
You think you'll get invited back?
I don't know. But here's the thing I thought was really funny. I talked about a roofer who couldn't get a job, wanted to be a roofer and make a living like his dad did in construction, and how it's hard if you're not a U.S. if you're a U.S. citizen. Now it's hard to do.
Yeah.
So later they brought that up as part of their comedy, and we're making fun of the roofer, and I just thought to myself, you know, the roofer character, and I thought to myself, you know, there was a time when liberals made fun of the rich instead of the working guy.
Yeah, there was a time, Kurt, when, you know, portions of the left sought out the support of the, I believe they called them the proletariat.
Yeah.
Right?
Instead, this is a punchline by a bunch of people living off their parents' trust funds as they, you know, suffer for their art.
Edgy.
Before they get serious and, you know, go back to the suburbs.
That's edgy right there, you know.
Yeah, it was sad. It's strange that the BMW driving trial lawyer is the guy who's trying to speak up for the dude who just wants to support his family working.
Well, because the BMW driving trial lawyer also remembers working fast food and remembers when he wasn't driving a BMW.
That is true.
Right?
I will never forget any of that, and I'm glad I did it. And I hope that California's $15 minimum wage doesn't prevent another generation of kids from learning how to work, though I fear it will.
I worry about that. Heck, your own governor worries about that, and he signed the legislation, Kurt. I mean, that's another segment entirely.
Pathetic.
Listen, buddy, we got like 15 seconds left. Thank you, as always, for coming on the program. I hope I get a chance to see you here soon.
I'm looking forward to it. I hope it works out.
All right, me too. Kurt Schlichter joining us. Buy his book, Conservative Insurgency. Read his columns. Tweet his stuff. And show your support however you can. That's going to do it for this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. Joining us on the program tomorrow, our friend Ed Morrissey. Going to be making a special appearance. You know, he's off on his book tour, but it just so happens he's in the D.C. area. I'm in the D.C. area, so Ed's going to join us in studio. Tony Katz on the program tomorrow as well. Andrew Langer and more. Have a fantastic rest of your day. We'll see you back here soon with another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.